Hey folks, we have a word from one of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sebade. They have a new sale, which starts on August 24th, 2026. Okay, I couldn't hear myself before, but I'm. It's good? All right, great. The sale started, I guess, earlier this week. 25% off new herbal tinctures from Sunset Lake Sebade. Our friends over there at Sunset Lake Farms just released a new line of tinctures formulated with organic Vermont-grown herbs, and they're offering 25% off introductory sale through September 1st. They've got the Herbal Focus Tincture, which has lion's mane in it, tulsi, and not the gabbard kind, in it, rosemary as well to boost concentration and stamina, so it has this great blend, the Herbal Relax Tincture, which combines milky oats, American skullcap lemon balm, and tulsi. We've got more tulsi here.
I'm the only hippie in the room who knows what all this means.
I don't. I mean,
I'm like skullcap. All right.
Rosemary, I've heard of. Tulsi helps reduce the irritation from daily stressors, or at least the relaxed tincture does. And then you've got the Herbal Sleep Tincture, which balances California poppy ashwagandha root, chamomile, all right, I'm not trying again, and lemon balm for a healthy night's rest without any morning fogginess. These alcohol-based tinctures are best used daily, and Sunset Lake recommends dropping them into a small glass of water or tea and using them instead of using them under your tongue like you would with these other tinctures. So this is a really cool new product from Sunset Lake. We've spoken about them many times.
I legitimately use the sleep tincture every night.
I do too. I use the lotion every day.
The other day, Sam, at the end of a show, announced that he spent basically a week's pay on sleep tincture.
Once you start, I mean, like, the product is so good, and they use regenerative farming practices, they are partially employee-owned, they've supported strike relief funds in the past, refugee resettlement as well. It's a company that you can feel good about supporting, and now they do have these new herbal tinctures with a sale that you can use until September 1st. At checkout, use the code HERBAL26. Herbal26 to save 25% on the new Sunset Lake Farms herbal tinctures now through September 1st at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. See their site for terms and conditions. Sunset Lake Sebade. Use code HERBAL26 to save 25% on the new Sunset Lake Farms herbal tinctures now through September 1st up to 11:59 p.m. Eastern. Now time for the show.
With Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, August 26th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Stuart Schrader, Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University, joins us to talk about his book, Blue Power, How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. And he also wrote a book called Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed Policing. Also on the program, in Georgia's 13th District, progressive Everton Blair has defeated the daughter of the deceased congressman in a special election upset. Took no AIPAC money as well. Sitting Senator Darlene Graham. I'm sorry, I'm such a coastal elitist with that, but it's very hard not to say her name like that. Darlene Graham. She wins.
I lived in Georgia for 13 years. I give you permission.
Thank you, sir. She wins the Senate runoff in South Carolina and will be on the ballot in November. Despite Trump's backing, she only won by like 5 points. Interesting story. The other Dan Sullivan will officially make it to the Alaska general election ballot.
Hell yeah.
It's amazing. Joining Senator Dan Sullivan, the Republican, and Mary Peltola in a key Senate race where flipping the Senate could potentially hinge. Canada announces retaliatory tariffs as high as 50% on hundreds of U.S. products, most notably steel and aluminum, which are important for building homes that we don't have enough of. This comes as the inflation numbers from July are worse than expected. CIA Director John Ratcliffe is in Moscow today, which is highly unusual. Meta just settled its social media addiction case for $17 billion after it was found that they downplayed child-related mental health harms. ICE arrests hit a monthly high in July. Nearly 50,000 people were taken by our American Gestapo. A federal judge finds that the Trump administration violated a nationwide injunction by directing the Postal Service to create new rules for mail-in ballots. The Washington Post reports that Hegseth fired the Army's top Army officer, after he started investigating the helicopter flyby of Kid Rock's Tennessee home.
I love paying taxes to pay for that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And we're paying taxes to make sure that anybody that chooses to investigate it is purged from the army. At least 75 people have been killed by flash floods in Nepal and China. And lastly, rest in peace, Dolly Parton, American icon, working class hero, mother to us all, supreme talent, LGBTQ ally. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is Hump Day. As a reminder, tomorrow Matt is going to be in the hosting chair, but you will hear a pre-recorded interview that I did as well. And we will have a show on Friday. Sam will either be live or pre-recording a Casual Friday episode. I'm leaving for a wedding tomorrow morning, so thank you to Matt for taking over. And you know, what will you cover? It'll be very exciting. People will have to tune in.
Probably the stacking of the Foreign Affairs Committee with Zionists, if I had to guess.
Yes.
And Anthony Edwards.
That too. We've got to get the basketball quota up. Let's start here. So, as I said in headlines, Canada has announced retaliatory tariffs that basically match the U.S. tariffs. Over the weekend, Trump is mad about Canada buying Chinese cars. He doesn't want China to have access to this extremely large automobile market in North America because we're a car country. But BYDs transportation.
But we're losing it and we're fumbling it and with all this stuff right now.
Of course. I mean, BYD's electric vehicles are a massive threat to the U.S. auto industry because they are cheap and they are superior on battery life, and electric vehicles are the future, and Canadians are going to start buying them.
And yeah, China subsidized them and helped them out. And so should we have
Yeah.
Instead, we just bailed out the car company so they could start making giant SUVs again. Maybe there's something to central planning that has the eye toward the future instead of just whatever they can maximize, you know, quarterly profits.
Right. So the U.S. tariffs certain goods like grocery goods, I think, over the weekend, dairy products, alcoholic beverages, certain things like bed sheets. And then Canada responded with like doubling the aluminum and steel tariffs to 50%, which is enormously significant for our economy and for any kind of infrastructure construction or home construction. So this is just another instance of Trump's usage of tariffs as like mafia style shakedowns, creating a level of uncertainty in the economy that has all these downstream effects in addition to raising prices, because the way that he's deployed tariffs have functioned as a compounding sales tax, which is a regressive tax that disproportionately hurts people the lower income that you have, because if the prices rise, that's a higher percentage of your income that you're forced to pay on goods and services that wealthier people can stomach more. And we have these inflation numbers that came out. The Fed has this preferred gauge that showed that core prices rose annually in July by 3.3%, and consumer spending is slowing. The inflation numbers are bad. The Republicans can't do anything but blame Biden and talk about trans people, I guess. So here's John Berman of CNN asking Pete Sessions, Republican of Texas, about these numbers and the out-of-control prices in this country right now.
John, the president was in reference to where it was when we took office. When he took office a year and a half ago, it is lower.
Congressman, no, it's not. Inflation was lower when he took office than it is now. It just is. Prices are, you know, inflation is higher now than when he first took office. It's gone up.
It was coming down. It was.
So can you look at, just pause for a second. Yeah. The graph on the screen is contradicting him, and you're seeing him, I guess that this is just looking at it from January on with Trump, but it's just absolutely true. It's increased since Trump took office.
Yeah, I mean, it had been at a very, very high after the pandemic, and it had lowered, and then it had been continuing to stay low.
Yes.
And then Trump started this dumb war.
Exactly.
Coming down. It was. So let's go right to your point. Has the president done things economically that would lower the cost of doing business? And the answer was, we were, until the war started. And once the war started, as you know, the gasoline prices have increased.
Who started that?
And the increase in gasoline prices have had a large effect off not only travel, but upon doing business. And that would be correct.
I will only note that the core PCE, which strips out food and energy, is also elevated at 3.3%. Even without the fuel prices high, Congressman.
Right.
Good job, actually, there, John Berman, in correcting that. Because also food prices are impacted by the war in Iran, given the fact that something like a third of the necessary materials for certain fertilizers comes through the Strait of Hormuz as well, because it's a byproduct of fossil fuels.
But of course, it is important to note that it's not just the energy because of the war that's stupid and pointless and evil, frankly. But it's also, these tariffs haven't helped the rest of the inflation either, obviously.
Lori Wallach spoke about it with us on Monday, and I'd recommend everybody check out that interview because she did such a good job of explaining certain technical parts of trade. But, you know, it's now a version of what we saw under Biden with greedflation, where you had supply chain bottlenecks due to COVID. Prices exploded because of that. There were labor shortages across the world as there were shutdowns, and, you know, it was difficult for trade to flow continuously. Prices went up, and then after the pandemic subsided and things got a little bit back to normal, prices still stayed high. And then you looked at these companies' earnings reports, and wow, record returns. We're seeing a version of that right now with the tariffs, where they're just blaming even the ones that have been deemed illegal by the Supreme Court, which was a majority of them, the Liberation Day tariffs that Trump was slapping onto everything. Well, now you can just raise prices and blame the tariffs, and there's really no control here because there's no cops on the beat right now in the Trump administration. In fact, they're speedrunning the collapse of small farms with their actions. And I would not be shocked if they're thrilled that their big ag buddies are able to gobble that stuff up on the cheap. This is a pro-consolidation fascistic administration. And Lina Khan, part of why things were going down, as you say, Matt, was there was, and Cantor in the Biden administration, there was like actually cops trying to enforce this stuff because it's been out of control. We're in a new Gilded Age in part because of these monopolies. And so Lina Khan was attempting to combat that. But now it's we have the opposite kind of posture in the administration. And just to give you a sense of how bad the economy is, CBS News, their streamer, where they still, we've figured out, they can sneak journalism through, and Barry doesn't seem to be paying too much attention to their streaming platform. They analyzed this new, this is a report on this new analysis about the true nature of unemployment in this country. Functional unemployment is how this group looks at the economy. It's their own specific formula, and it's laid out here in the CBS News reporting. Here they explain how bad the actual the actual job market is in this country right now.
While the U.S. unemployment rate remains near a 50-year low, an economic research firm shines a light on a disturbing figure regarding our job market. As of July, the unemployment rate stood at 4.1%, but according to data from the Ludwig Institute for Shared Economic Prosperity, the true rate of unemployment was actually at 24.9%. Now, the economic research firm looks not only at unemployed workers and those searching for a job to capture a real look at the labor market, but also those who are something called functionally unemployed. Now, that includes those who are involuntarily working part-time and who are earning poverty-level wages, or less than $26,000 annually, and that's before taxes. So CBS MoneyWatch reporter Megan Cerullo joins me now. So what does the unemployment rate measure versus that functional unemployment?
The official unemployment rate from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which we all rely on as an indicator of the health of the labor market, measures the share of workers who are 16 and older who are looking for work and don't have jobs.
Got it.
So it's very blunt. The creator of this other alternative measure, which captures the share of workers who are functionally unemployed, includes those workers, as well as workers who are involuntarily working part-time. So they want full-time jobs. They don't have them. They may only be working a few hours a week, as well as those workers who are earning poverty-level wages.
Can you pause for a second just to keep that up there? This is important. This is including gig work. This is including poverty wages. Basically, a quarter of the country is unable to stay afloat, even if the unemployment rate is staying steady, because of how weakened our labor standards have been in this country and how these big tech companies have hollowed out the labor market by circumventing it at traditional employment measures with, you know, say, like, benefits and stuff for gig workers who have way fewer protections. Let's keep going.
Helps explain the chasm between the two figures, the 4.1% and the almost 25% of workers who are characterized as functionally unemployed. And it's because it includes these folks who can't afford nutritious meals and maybe don't have adequate shelter. Its creator, Gene Ludwig, told me that, you know, you could be homeless and have worked 1 hour for the past week, and you'd be considered as having a job.
Okay, so when you look at that functionally unemployment rate, what does it tell you about the labor market in general?
It suggests that it might not be as rosy as it seems. The rate of functionally unemployed workers has risen for the past 4 months. Mm-hmm. Labor force participation rate is declining, and normally in a strong labor market, if there were good jobs, employers were paying high wages, that would lure folks in. But it suggests that workers are having a hard time finding good jobs. And we do know that inflation is outpacing wage gains. And so workers are earning raises, But if you get a 3% raise, inflation's at 4%, that's going to feel like a 1% pay cut.
It's a race. Yeah, I think.
I thought that was a shockingly informative segment from CBS News on that particular study. The labor market, it's being held together by duct tape and glue, essentially. The economy and the stock market is overinflating artificial intelligence, which, if you were to even buy into the fact that this is going to be the future of the United States economy, that would mean that it would further that very rate of functional unemployment, because what it's being advertised as to the investor class is a way to essentially cut costs, and the easiest way to do that is to cut labor, just be replaced by AI.
Elon Musk was on The Economist's podcast for about 90 minutes, and that's what he said is, actually, no one's going to be working in 10 years. The robots are going to become so smart and so competent that even he, as CEO of a company that, frankly, like, takes great pains to make sure that he has sole control over his companies as opposed to his board or whatever, he'll say he'll just turn over his keys to Tesla and SpaceX to the robot.
Yeah.
Because it'll be better than him, obviously.
Oh, sure.
But this was the world's richest man to one of the world's oldest economic publications. And this is the type of fantasy shit that they're talking about. It should scare people.
But I would imagine that technology is going to be democratized, right? So that workers don't have to work as hard, maybe?
Yeah, all the AI company, it's not going to be governments that do this. It's going to be the CEOs of the AI companies getting together and doing what Elon Musk calls basic high income.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Let's now just talk about Dolly Parton for a second. I mean, normally we wouldn't talk about an artist or a singer passing away like this, but I just think she's so culturally significant and such a great American that it warrants its own segment. I made the mistake this morning of listening to Dolly Parton on the subway on my headphones, just fully crying in front of people.
If I saw you on the train crying, I would think she's probably listening to Dolly Parton. I'm dead serious.
I mean, that's
today.
That's what I was doing.
I would have thought that.
I was just had some of her top songs like on repeat. I was listening in the shower this morning, and then I chose to cry in public as opposed to in the shower in private.
Right.
About Dolly Parton. But I mean, what a great American. She came from a poor background in rural Tennessee, never forgot her roots. Her song, A Coat of Many Colors, about how her mother stitched together a coat for her, is really what was getting me on the train this morning. She started an imagination library, which was about, you know, getting kids to read and combating book bans.
Her father was illiterate.
Oh, wow. That's I didn't know that.
That's part of the premise of that.
Her musical prowess was incredible. Just an amazing artist, and 9 to 5 is this feminist pro-worker anthem, as well as a classic film that she wrote, still as relevant today as ever. She acted to Steel Magnolias is kind of a bizarre film that I saw for the first time recently, but she's the best part of it, actually. Weird performance by Julia Roberts. Anyway, also a staunch ally of the LGBTQ community. Here she is on Larry King, defending the LGBTQ community through a lens of, like, compassionate Christianity.
Didn't you recently, though, throw support to the LGBT community?
Oh, I'm always encouraged. I'm not encouraged. They've made me the poster child, I think, only because I'm so outspoken as far as just being accepting of people in general. I do not believe that we should criticize and judge other people. I think we should be accepting and loving. We are all God's children. We are who we are, and we should be allowed to be who we are.
Did any of the faith-based communities that deeply believe the other way take umbrage with you?
Oh, absolutely.
They did?
Oh, yes. I get it all the time. I keep saying, well, if you're the fine Christian that you think you are, why are you judging people? Why are you... That's God's job. We're not God. We're not judges. You know, we're supposed to love one another. We're supposed to not judge. And we're not supposed to take vengeance on other people. That's God's job. So I got too much to do on my own, try to do God's work, too. I mean, not to, you know, to get into trying to do all that. So, yeah, I suffer for everything I do. I'm not out to make any, you know, I just think that we should be
Why not?
More loving, more caring. We are who we are. If you're gay, you're gay. If you're straight, you're straight. And you should be allowed to be, you know, how you are and who you are.
There's Dolly standing up for queer people, gay people, trans people. Here she is talking about the Imagination Library that we just talked about. I didn't realize how this got started in the 90s, I think. Was it
in started response? In 95. It originally started in the county she's from in Tennessee. And then it grew, and they've donated over 3 million books to 5 and under children.
God, that's amazing. I mean, we've been talking about Angie Nixon and her candidacy, who also kind of has a bookstore down in Jacksonville in this spirit. It's like one of the most beautiful ways that you could dedicate your resources educating children and combating censorship.
And just in terms of like research, it's maybe the most important thing. Just the presence of books in a household for children when they're in their developmental stages is like night and day for what that means for their lifetime enrichment.
Yes, exactly. Here she is talking about her efforts on childhood literacy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dolly. Before he passed away, my daddy told me that the Imagination Library probably was the most important thing I'd ever done. Now, I can't tell you how much that meant to me because I created the Imagination Library as a tribute to my daddy. He was the smartest man I've ever known, but I knew in my heart his inability to read probably kept him from seeing all his dreams come true. Inspiring kids to love to read became my mission. In the beginning, my hope was simply to inspire the children in my home county. But here we are today with a worldwide program that gives a book a month to over 1 million children. Of course, I have not done this alone. The real heroes of our story was the thousands of local organizations who have embraced my dream and made it their own. They raise millions of dollars each year and wake up every day with a passion to make sure that their kids have every opportunity to succeed. It's been quite a journey, but we have so much more left to do. Now, I'd love for your community to join our family, so please take the time to explore our website. Let's share this dream that all children should grow up in a home full of books. The first step is always the hardest, but you will never know unless you try.
I can't think of a public figure who radiates
Mr.
such.
Rogers.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here. That's the level we're on. Republicans, of course, hated her efforts to educate the kids, cut funding for
this is now.
Right now. Oh my God, I just saw the date. Republicans cut funding for Dolly Parton's child reading program, reports Newsweek here. Not shocking. Although Trump took credit. Or at the very least said Dolly Parton really liked me this morning. So classy as always. And
she's like, yeah, you actually won the 2020 election, she told me right before she died.
Yeah.
We need to pass the SAVE Act. That was her last words.
And she talked about how we should bomb Iranian civilian infrastructure.
Yeah, I'll pass that daggum SAVE Act.
Exactly.
Her website or the Imagination Library website is just imaginationlibrary.com. If you feel like giving a donation, it turns out I undersold there. It says 300 million books.
Whoa.
Gifted. You're off by 100 times.
I saw the 3 million books gifted to registered children.
Holy moly. Can we put this on the screen?
Yeah.
Look at that. Oh no, it's all right. But there it is. Look at that. Okay, we'll put a link to that down below, Dolly Parton.
It's 3 million a month.
That's unreal. She's done so much good. And she could have hoarded her money, and she gave away a lot of her money. A lot. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, there's just a lot of books that you can get through this that have been banned for insane reasons. Like, this is a way to circumvent book banning and things you can't have access to in your school, and that's not nefarious in any way.
Yep.
It's just like... about like children who aren't white,
exactly. Right. Or maybe gay.
Right.
Um,
I don't know. She did make it. She did make all these libraries carry the anarchist cookbook. I heard.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
did Dolly Parton support
Molotov sippy cup?
Did Dolly Parton? What did Dolly Parton have to say about the campaign of Kashama Sawant? Did she support Kashama Sawant? Anyway, we're making fun of stupid leftist purity testing because Dolly Parton was a wonderful, wonderful human being.
All the nicest people I've ever met in my life live in blue islands in the middle of surrounded by red. Like when I lived in Athens, Georgia, like especially in the South.
Jen Welch is carrying
exactly.
the flame. Yeah.
It takes a lot to, I mean, I was just a regular person, just dressed like a punk, and I would get called slurs all the time and have beer cans thrown at my head on the side of the street. So like the guts it takes to be yourself in a lot of those towns is really hard. It usually turns out some mighty fine people.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I remember getting called the F slur wearing a pea coat walking down Fargo's yeah. Broadway. But it is.
Sorry about that.
basically it's like college towns often, or any sort of area with any kind of a downtown. A lot of those people, I mean, even you look at the voting data, like, you know,
right.
Being among people is good for your socialization skills and ability to not be driven by fear and
your
paranoia
empathy.
And dumb horseshit about like whether Enos Kanter can play in the WNBA.
Well, it's why suburban people are so like freaked out by the New York Post, because then they see crime and they get to, you know, feel very paranoid in their little kind of fiefdom. But just a few IMs about, because people are having a strong reaction to this, and then I want to get to our guests. But Sammy from YS says, I'm transgender. My own mother doesn't accept me. My state government wants me dead. Dolly was 80 years old and from Tennessee. Dolly loved people like me and advocated for people like me. She was a good Christian. She was a good person. Rest in peace, Gorge. This is amazing. Cauliflower writes in, secondhand story from a friend. A trans woman sent a painted portrait and a letter to Dolly letting her know how much her music mattered to her during her transition, and Dolly paid for her top surgery. Wow. Oh, man. All right. Love Dolly Parton. Rest in peace. And it sucks that she was the only 80-year-old. She was the 80-year-old who had to die yesterday. There's another one who also loves makeup, also is theatrical, and who's doing a lot of harm right now. Who?
Oh, for a second, I thought you were talking about Tim Curry. That's why, again, I was like, take it easy.
I'm sorry. Rest in peace, Tim Curry, as well. In a moment, we are going to be talking to Stuart Schrader about his book, Blue Power, How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. But first, a word from one of our sponsors. You know, sometimes you can get these subscriptions and they are in, you know, recurring, automatic, etc., and you don't know how you're spending. I was wanting to get a handle on some of those subscriptions, like you end up have an annual for an app that you forgot about, or for like a paper that you no longer read. Rocket Money was able to help me figure all of that out and figure out where I was overspending, and I was able to cut back and kind of streamline that using Rocket Money's tools. Rocket Money has automatic transaction categorization across accounts, plus customizable categories and tags to reveal spending patterns. Especially when I was getting married last year, right? Like, there's a lot of expenses that go into that, so you have to be on top of your finances. And I was able to have that kind of overwhelming task simplified for me a little bit with Rocket Money. So you can have automated savings that grow towards goals with adjustable amounts and frequency, and you can put that into Rocket Money. And you have a set it and forget it kind of approach here from Rocket Money. So it allows you to just basically kind of have guardrails for yourself and have peace of mind when you are dealing with all of the day-to-day expenses in your life. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/ Majority. That's rocketmoney.com/majority. Rocketmoney.com/majority. We'll put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Rocketmoney.com/majority. Quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Stuart Schrader. We are back, and we are joined now by Dr. Stuart Schrader, Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University, where he directs the Chloe Center for the Critical Study of Racism, Immigration, and Colonialism. His new book is called Blue Power: How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. Dr. Schrader, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's talk about really just the overarching premise of the book, how American police seized political power in this country. And maybe we could, it'd be helpful to talk about how policing got started even as an institution in this country, and also how it connects to America as a capitalist country as well.
Sure. Well, the book Blue Power is about a movement that began in the 1960s and continues to this day by police, largely led by their unions and other types of associations, to influence our politics in the country on their own behalf. So police unions in their contemporary form really came into existence toward the end of the 60s as part of a broader shift to public sector unionization that swept the country. Police were part of that. And they used newfound power and resources that they gained to try to influence the legislative process. And they really fused this energy for gaining collective bargaining rights with a reaction against the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. And even the second wave feminist movement. Police adopted a kind of reactionary political stance at that time. They endorsed cries for, you know, law and order and getting tough on crime in very self-serving ways that would increase their compensation and make their jobs, adhere to a variety of preferences that they had. And that would also give them a lot of impunity and protection from accountability. You know, the period of the 1960s was a moment when there was a lot of discussion of how to make police more effective as crime fighters, make police better able to control protests and uprisings that were happening. And, you know, the police reaction to this was that they were being constrained. And certainly calls for greater effectiveness, they worried, were calls for more outside external control. And so they resisted this, and they used their unions and associations to push back. And they've been extremely successful. The history I chart in the book is a story of local, state, and federal level gains in the kind of influence and power of police to the point that I would say in many cities, it's really been the case that rather than police answering to elected officials, it's really the other way around, that many elected officials are answering to police because they're intimidated and scared of the both political muscle they have, the resources they have, the electoral influence they have, and the ability they have to disrupt the regular, everyday functioning of city government by slowing down their enforcement or even illegally going on strike.
So is that what makes American policing unique? There was a stat in your book that was jarring to me, that U.S. police are responsible for 13% of global police killings, and we're 4% of the global population here in the United States. So obviously it's more lethal than other forms of policing, certainly on average. What is it, that organizing power, that makes it unique? What are the characters of American policing versus, say, the rest of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. And to get back to your original question, it's certainly true that police in other parts of the world are deeply integrated in protecting the, you know, smooth functioning of capitalism, you know, protecting private property, making sure that workers don't go on strike or people don't protest. You know, that's true everywhere. But when we start to look at, you know, other highly developed countries like the United States, the police here really are an outlier, just as the United States is an outlier in terms of incarceration rates. And so, yeah, one of the reasons I started to do this research into the political power of police was to try to make sense of this. You know, on the one hand, I think we do, especially in the aftermath of Black Lives Matter and the protest waves of 2014, 2015, 2020, you know, there's been a lot of really great scholarship, journalism, and other, you know, analysis of how police operate in the streets and their kind of everyday operations and all the injustices that go along with that. But I think there's been less attention to their political organizing kind of behind closed doors. And that was what I wanted to make better sense of. I think lots of people will know, you know, in their own city, there might be a police union president who's boisterous, who gets a lot of attention from the local news media. But I think people are a little bit less attuned to the way, and I certainly was when I began the research, to the way that these folks are part of a large organized movement that's been persistent and consistent over decades. And they're, you know, they're really talking to each other, sharing best practices, trying to figure out what works in one place, whether it's going to work in another place. And so I trace this history. And I do think that this is something that distinguishes the police in the United States as compared to other places. Certainly, you know, there are, because of the federal decentralized system that the United States has, there are many, many police departments and therefore many, many police unions and other types of associations that wield political power. And there isn't really a comparable equivalent in other countries because the police departments and agencies are not organized the same way. And so when you have police in towns and cities who are then organized into statewide federations, which are then organized into national organizations, they really bring quite a lot of political heft and are able to marshal a lot of resources. And this is, I think, one aspect of trying to make sense of policing and the kind of bigger picture of the criminal punishment system that we have not paid sufficient attention to. And so I hope that, you know, this book is alerting readers to a kind of hidden dimension of our political system. You know, in some ways, it's kind of been hiding in plain sight.
Right. Their political power is key to understanding why we've been unable to do comprehensive criminal justice reform in this country. Let's then go back to their origin, and you talk about police unions and their beginning to really organize themselves in a more militant way, being a response to the civil rights movement. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book starts in Detroit, where there was in the 1960s a quite progressive mayor who was getting a lot of national attention. He was, you know, on the cover of magazines like Time, because it seemed as though Detroit, not only was it this industrial powerhouse, but it was a city where some of the promises of kind of urban progressive liberalism were being borne out. It was a city where people thought that poverty was being reduced, you know, racial tensions were declining. Of course, that turned out not to be true, and the rebellion in 1967 is the best proof of this. But at the same time that the mayor, whose name was Jerome Kavanaugh, was gaining this kind of national profile as a standard bearer for kind of progressive urban liberalism, the police union, which came into existence some decades earlier, but was really a social club, by the 1960s, it became a political organization. It really self-consciously became a political organization. And so it was trying to get a contract. And in the history, many people will know the history of the uprising that happened in 1967, which was, you know, really devastating to the city. But what's been forgotten is that this happened in the midst of the police union trying to obtain its contract. And it actually did finally get the contract it was desiring, which Kavanaugh had been resistant to signing. It finally got it right after the 1967 rebellion. And once the union got this contract, it really went on the warpath against urban liberalism. And so what I would argue is that it wasn't just the idea of gaining representation, signing a contract, getting a really good salary. The Detroit police officers were able to get one of the highest salaries in the country at this point. It wasn't just that. It was that they also saw their mission as destroying the political career of this progressive mayor who really saw himself as somebody who could try to heal some of the trauma and divisions in the city that both led to and resulted from the rebellion.
And I just, you know, can I pause there for a second for some, sure. a modern analog? This is part of why perhaps Zoran Mamdani has yet to pick a fight with the police commissioner Tish here in New York City as he attempts to get his agenda items across. As a student of history, he's quite adept at that stuff. I would imagine he was aware of this example.
Well, yeah, and the Detroit Police Officers Association really created what I would consider a blueprint. It wasn't just get a contract, get good benefits, get a good salary. It was tie the demand for that type of remuneration with a demand to destroy a kind of progressive political program. And it's the book shows that over and over again across the country, police unions follow this sort of blueprint. And it's absolutely true that even in New York City, you know, people will point to the mayoralty of Bill de Blasio, which is where the book ends, as another example of this, where he was a progressive who was elected on promises to rein in some of the abuses that the NYPD had been engaging in through its stop and frisk practices that Bloomberg and the police commissioner Ray Kelly had overseen. And he was immediately challenged by the police unions in the city, and to the point that, you know, they were basically in open rebellion. Now, the question of Mamdani is an interesting one, because some of the political situation has changed. The police unions are not led by the same type of firebrands who were very, very successful police union leaders as under de Blasio. And, you know, the state government is different. There are more progressives in the state legislature. So some of the ways that the police unions had succeeded in New York was to try to get what they wanted from the state rather than through the city, because they thought, well, we can rely on maybe some more conservative elected officials in Albany. And that's less true, but it is still the case that, you know, the current, the contract for the police officers of the NYPD has expired. And the police union said that it could not come to an agreement with the Mamdani administration, and it has asked for the state to intervene, and it's going to arbitration. And this is a very traditional tactic of this police union to try to get state-level intervention because they don't think they can get what they want from the city. And, you know, I show in the book that, again, these types of mechanisms that are intended to benefit police, you know, they came out of concerted political mobilization, fighting legislative battles, fighting court battles if the legislation was challenged. And this is really what Blue Power is about, is this kind of very complicated behind-the-scenes political maneuvering, both to get the right candidates into office who will do more or less what police unions ask them to do, and then, you know, get the legislation passed, wage the court battles, work with the arbitrators if it comes to arbitration. And it, so it's complicated to make sense of, and it's not necessarily all that flashy. But then when a very high-profile incident does occur, the killing of, you know, Eric Garner or George Floyd, something like that, you know, these police unions and the organizations that police belong to are ready to spring into action, consolidate and speak with a unified voice, and they know how to pull the levers of power of you know, in legislature, yeah, in the courts, et cetera.
So, I mean, pulling the levers of power, it's fascinating how you explore this, particularly when dealing with Democrats versus Republicans. You write about how Democrats have traditionally tried to cooperate with commanders in police departments, and the Republicans are more working with the rank-and-file cops. And I was struck by how that mirrors the current class dynamics of both political constituencies right now. Can you describe that and even bring in some national figures into your description and examples?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the history of policing in the 20th century in the United States is a history of attempts at reform, kind of responding to crisis. And these have often been led by the commanding officers. They tend to be kind of technocratic, you know, oriented toward reform, oriented toward improving training, introducing new technologies, and so forth. And going back to Lyndon Johnson and even earlier, these chiefs were broadly aligned with Democrats. And when Republicans in the 1960s started, you know, spouting law and order rhetoric and talking about getting tough on crime, many of the rank and file police organizations, the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the biggest one, you know, they saw themselves as more aligned with the Republican Party, which, you know, really did not want to brook any criticism of police. They were not really interested in reform, and police officers were happy to hear that. But it came to be the case that over time, particularly in Washington, if police wanted to get major legislation passed, they needed to have bipartisan support. And so the most important figure who I talk about in the book, who was able to kind of figure out how to not only get every type of police officer to agree to things, you know, say sheriffs, urban police officers, state troopers, et cetera, not only get all the different types of police officers to agree, but also to get both sides of the aisle to agree, that was Joe Biden. And Joe Biden, from the beginning of his career in the 1970s, all the way through to the 1994 crime bill, which he really largely crafted and oversaw its passage, you know, he was the one who said, I'm going to find a way to kind of bridge these divides, get the commanders and the rank and file to agree, because we will offer, particularly in the 94 crime bill, amazing amounts of resources for the police. The tagline for the 94 crime bill, the way it was sold to the public by Biden and by the Clinton administration, was that it would provide 100,000 new police officers across the United States. There would be so much money available that the crime problem would be ameliorated because there would be so many new cops on the streets, and they would be engaging in community policing and other types of proactive measures. And so, you know, Biden was really explicit. I say in the book that he says in his speeches on the floor of the Senate, you know, he says, when I tried to figure out the best way to deal with crime, I did not think about, you know, root causes. I didn't think about poverty. I didn't think about the trauma that young people were experiencing.
Nice flex.
Yeah. Instead, I called the cops. He literally says this. I called the cops. And what he means is that he spoke to these organizations that I've been mentioning, from the Fraternal Order of Police to the National Sheriff's Association to the International Association of Chiefs of Police, these professional representatives of police all over the country, and said, what do you guys want? And what can Congress do for you? And it turned out it was to basically throw money at police.
He's Biden perfected that, calling what do you guys want, both with cops and with Israel, interestingly. Now, I mean, I mentioned that you are at Johns Hopkins University, which is in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm struck by that because, of course, the war on drugs kind of follows shortly after this period that you talk about of the proliferation of police organizing themselves, the late 1960s, and then really the war on drugs begins in the 1970s. How do you connect those two dynamics? And I would imagine you'd say that, like, they were obviously linked and feeding off of one another.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I would say two things. I mean, one is that the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on terror, you know, all of these so-called wars have showered money on the police departments across the country. They've, you know, also provided money for you know, jails and prisons. So, you know, when we think about what they actually entail, in large part, they're kind of rhetorical devices that kind of cover the just dissemination of money from Washington, you know, from the budget that the Congress approves. Now, police oftentimes were really thrilled to kind of lean into the rhetoric. Yeah, crime is going up. Yes, drug abuse is getting worse and worse. Yes, there is a threat of terrorism, because they knew that they stood to benefit from this. And I think that one of the kind of hallmarks of blue power, as I discuss it in the book, is that on the one hand, if there is a increase in crime, or there is an increase, say, in drug overdoses, as has happened in recent years, you know, cops respond and say, well, look, we need more money, we need more resources, we need more protection from meddling oversight in order to get the job done, so that we can bring these, you know, horrific rates of crime and death and destruction down. And if those rates do actually go down, which may or may not have anything to do with the activities of police, then they say, well, you know what, we should be rewarded for the good job we've done.
Yep.
And so the discourse of blue power is they always find a way to say, look, at the end of the day, we need more. We need more freedom to do our jobs without the, you know, oversight of civilian complaint review boards, or you know, prying prosecutors who might be looking for evidence of corruption or malfeasance, or internal affairs bureaus. We need to get rid of all that stuff, and we also need, you know, more money so that cops are rewarded with good pay and benefits for the work that they do. And it certainly is true that in big cities, and especially in wealthy suburbs across the country, cops are, you know, very handsomely compensated, with a lot of benefits that regular workers in other professions, and even in other public sector professions, you know, would be thrilled to receive. And, you know, I think that the kind of takeaway from that is that these funds from the government to give public sector workers, you know, good compensation, good benefits, you know, they are available. Right now, they're generally just confined, you know, to police and sometimes firefighters, who, you know, get much better public approval than police. But, you know, it does provide a model for how we could treat you know,
teachers
a lot better.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
any
that's,
public
that's
sector
the best
worker.
Example.
Yeah, it is amazing to think about how we could redirect resources in a way that helps, you know, our other public sector workers and not just exclusively the police. But, you know, part of what's so striking about this, I think, is how policing is profitable in its current construction to a lot of different industries. I mean, the connections, I think, with the war on terror are really important and the post 9/11 policing ecosystem. Can you talk about how the militarization of police and that level of militarization was put on steroids in the post 9/11 America?
Yeah, absolutely. The Department of Homeland Security came into existence, you know, a little bit after 9/11, and it you know, provided grants to police all over the country, and there was already the practice that many of your listeners will be familiar with of the Pentagon giving surplus material to police departments, but that also really ramped up in the aftermath of 9/11 and certainly during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan when there was a lot of surplus material to be distributed. And so that hasn't really abated all that much, but now I do think that we're in a moment when some of the technologies available are starting to change the scenario for police, because the attractiveness of drones, the attractiveness of different types of digital surveillance technologies, and certainly AI, you know, these technologies are always offered as a kind of like magic bullet. They will make policing more precise. It will reduce the likelihood of, you know, villains getting away with crime or other malicious acts. And it will also make it so that the job of police is easier, safer, et cetera. You know, I'm very wary of those types of promises, but that's the selling point. And I think that, you know, police representatives know to endorse those types of selling points because it always seems like a win-win. You know, we're going to fix the crime problem or the public safety problem, and it's also going to provide a benefit to police. You know, the argument for, you know, armored vehicles is largely about, you know, protecting police. The arguments that are being made right now for, you know, surveillance drones and potentially even armed drones in the future, you know, AI types of fueled types of surveillance technologies, you know, the promises are, you know, kind of utopian, and they are made as like kind of science fiction come true. And, you know, the questions that I think we have to ask, just the most basic questions, like on the one hand are questions about our rights and, you know, right to privacy and so forth. And then on the other hand, about the costs, you know, where is the money for all of these going to come from, and where is the money for them going to go? It's going to go largely into the hands of the most kind of, you know, evil kind of caricature billionaires.
Right. Well, I mean, they are behind these tech overlords that are now trying to sell drone surveillance technology and AI surveillance to police departments are the ones that talk about how San Francisco is a hellhole, how these urban centers are dangerous. And I don't think it's a coincidence that social media giants elevate some of that kind of inflammatory crime content to make it go viral to increase that perception. This is really after the George Floyd protests. This was for years, I think, and I don't have, this is just from observation, I don't have data to back it up, but it seemed abundantly clear to me that this was being elevated by these tech giants that want to sell surveillance technology to police departments. So gin up panic about crime.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think we've all seen it, you know, with our own eyes, that there is just so much fear mongering content available, you know, and in some ways it's an old story, but also it's just ramified and intensified by the, you know, availability of these social media technologies and other types of technologies to put it in right in front of our face.
Right. Like previously, it would just be on the New York Post or in your local news. If it bleeds, it leads kind of thing. Yeah. But now it's at the top of your algorithm. And so before we wrap, now that I mentioned the New York Post, it occurs to me that we should probably touch on two central figures in the world of American policing on the Republican side. Donald Trump and his buddy, Rudy Giuliani, very much a creature of the NYPD himself. What did you find in your research about those two figures in American politics and their relationship to policing?
Well, for both of them, goes back quite a long way. I mean, Giuliani, I think many people sort of know that in the 1990s, he was a tough-on-crime mayor, but he was a tough-on-crime official all the way back in the 1970s. He worked in the Ford administration, and then he worked in the Reagan administration. He was largely in charge of Reagan's approach to street crime, which was somewhat inconsistent because, you know, again, Biden always had the idea of sending money to police, and the Reagan administration, at least at first, wanted to cut government spending. And so, you know, again, like Biden kind of figured out how to break that sort of impasse. But Giuliani was at the center of it. He was always spouting really very acerbic rhetoric that we know him for from when he was mayor. And I write about him a bunch in the book, in part because he had a very close relationship with the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, the officers' union in New York City, and they helped to actually get him into office. And some people may know that there was this really outrageous incident that's kind of referred to as the City Hall riot that Giuliani was at the center of. And it was all about criticizing the mayor, David Dinkins, the first African-American mayor of New York City, because he wanted to institute more civilian review of the NYPD. And so the PBA, in concert with Giuliani, led a protest that devolved into total mayhem on the steps of City Hall. And that was really when Giuliani made clear that he, you know, had sort of figured out how to campaign on this kind of tough on crime mantle with sort of thinly veiled racism behind it. And that was going to propel him into City Hall. And it was quite successful. And then, you know, Donald Trump, too, he appears throughout this history. You know, the PBA and other organizations like that, they've been giving him awards since, you know, the 80s. He's been going to their banquets.
He loves those. That's a pretty great way to get to his heart, we've figured out,
absolutely.
Every world leader and FIFA, what have you.
Yeah. And, you know, and of course, one of his first forays into politics was an attempted intervention into the so-called Central Park jogger case, where, you know, he demanded the death penalty for the young men who were arrested for that crime, which they ultimately were shown not to have committed. And so, you know, he always has been trying to espouse, you know, tough on crime rhetoric, and he and Giuliani, I think, really saw something in one another, and the PBA as well. They're all, it's a kind of triumvirate of reactionary power in New York City that has had really national level implications, and I explain a bunch of this in the book as I bring it up to the present in the conclusion.
Lastly, we just have a viewer who has a question for you. Jay Tingle writes, please ask your guest about San Francisco Mayor George Moscone. I'm not sure if you have a story about that.
I do. In fact, I have a couple chapters about San Francisco in the book. The San Francisco Police Officers Association became a very militant police union in the 1970s. It went on strike, and it also kind of was one of the first police unions to figure out how to leap from the city government to the state government to get its way. You know, the city government in San Francisco was, you know, not fully progressive, but full of progressives. It had a few. And that was frustrating to the Police Officers Association. So they said, all right, we're going to see what we can do in Sacramento and get our way there. And that became, again, a blueprint for other police unions. Moscone was a liberal mayor who he came in the aftermath of the strike. And the police union absolutely did not like him. And, you know, the story, which you may be familiar with, it's a really horrific story. He was assassinated along with Harvey Milk by a former police officer. And that former police officer, whose name was Dan White, after he committed this assassination, you know, he went and turned himself in. And he said, you know, I want to turn myself in to somebody who I trust. And the person he trusted was a police union official who was very powerful. I think to this day is maybe still active in the police union. You know, the politics of this history of blue power, there's a lot, that's maybe the most grotesque incident, but there's a lot of really grotesque incidents that I trace in the book where the opposition to, again, urban liberalism takes really dramatic and intense and pointed forms. You know, nowadays we're accustomed to seeing maybe tweets from police union heads that are really outrageous. And certainly that happened with de Blasio in 2020 when his daughter was doxxed by a police union head. But it's gone far beyond that to, you know, threats of physical violence and intimidation and so forth. And the book is full of examples of this throughout the decades.
Well, I really encourage people to check it out. The book is called Blue Power: How Police Organize to Protect and Serve Themselves. And Stuart Schrader, you can read his other work as well, Badges Without Borders: How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed Policing. But we'll put a link to Blue Power down below wherever people are listening to or watching this. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. With that, folks, we're going to head into the fun half shortly. I did want to just say, since I won't be in tomorrow, Liliana, our intern, last day tomorrow, shout out. I'm giving you a shout out. Been doing incredible work, doing awesome work, amazing, amazing intern helping us out here
archiving
on the Majority
the
Report.
Ancient Majority Report origins.
Exactly, dealing with our 12 to 15 year old equipment.
You'll have Liliana to thank for when on the best ofs for like Christmas or whatever, have for members, have archive, deep archive inclusions. That's really kind of what this is about, at least as far as I know.
They've been awesome. Thanks so much, Liliana, for all
that
of
is
your
grandma.
Help this summer. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. Join themajoritireport.com.
Oh, look what I found.
Watch Hillary examine the
oh, Jesus Christ.
The campaign with the man, Tim Kaine. Ah, Tim Kaine in the membrane. Tim Kaine in the brain.
You're aware that this causes me psychic damage, right? Every time you do it. Every time you do it.
I'm glad I remembered what page this is on.
Right. I mean, wow. Honestly.
Yeah, that made me feel really bad.
Yes.
I got a rush out of it.
Every time you play that, it's like a year's worth of meth use. That's the damage that is like being inflicted upon my body right now. I'm bleeding from my brain.
Watch Hillary examine the terrain.
Ugh. I love to watch Hillary examine the terrain. I put a Hillary clip, by the way, in Slack, right? Did I not? I don't know if we have that on our sound sheet. She weighed into the current political discourse.
Oh, she's talking about Jeff. Something to say about that. Hassan Piker?
No, it's okay. Maybe we'll just pull it up and if we feel like it in the fun.
Hassan
half,
Piker is bad. Is that what she said, or what is she talking about?
I sent it in Slack, but again, you just made my brain atrophy, so I need a second. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. You get access to the fun half. You can IM the show, all that good stuff. Also, shop.majorityreportradio.com. You can get the Jeffrey Cycle shirts for a limited time. Those are available. Shop.majorityreportradio.com.
I mean, you got to be flying off the shelves now after... one day after meeting with Jared Kushner, he both decides that Hassan Piker is the thing we need to be talking about again, and puts a bunch of Zionists like Jared Moskowitz and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Wesley Bell on the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Oh, God.
A literal murderer's row.
Exactly. Oh, man. All right.
So, cool stuff.
Cool stuff.
Cool stuff.
See you in the fun.
Did you not plug Matt's show?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I was distracted.
Both of you.
Doing the Tim Kaine drop.
What's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Bitter O'Rourke joined us on Left Reckoning to talk about his project to get low-propensity voters out, and we also asked him about AIPAC. Can Democratic Party coexist with the Israel lobby? And I'm happy to say that he introduced the word genocide into the conversation before we could. And we also talked about Zohra Mamdani and whether there needs to be an exorcism of the far left, or if it's actually maybe a source of finding its principles. So yeah, check that out. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get our Sunday show.
All right. See you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
Yeah, I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
Sir, I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why. So was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. Was offered a tour.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour. Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys. Was offered a tour. Sushi and
that's what we call biz.
Tour. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour. Sushi and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk. Ugh. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk.
Wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered a twerk.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk. Sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a little kid. Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid. Twerk.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here. Okay, all right.
It's not a fun job.
Twerk.
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Willy Wonka.
Twerk.
That's a real thing.
That's
real thing.
Real thing.
What's that offered?
Twerk.
That's a real thing.
That's
real thing.
Real thing.
That's
twerk.
A real thing.
That's
real thing.
Real thing.
What's that offered?
Twerk. Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered
twerk.
That's a real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
That
offered
twerk.
That's a real thing.
That's
poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, Tim.
Twerk. Sushi and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Twerk.
Deluded.
Sushi.
You don't have a clue as to what's going on. Live YouTube.
Sam has
Twitch.
The weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Right.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh,
sorry.
She wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
God.
Incredible.
Incredibles theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like period.
We are back, folks. It is the fun half of the Majority Report. I forgot to say call into the phones. We will try to take some calls today because I know we meant to yesterday, and we hadn't. I'll read some IMs while we do that. Jobby Boonier, you guys are being short-sighted. We should absolutely support Hillary and Jeffries at all to duel like Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander Hamilton.
That would be, I mean... That would be fun to see. Militant apathy. True story. Firefighters are some of the worst, most racist sociopathic MFers you can imagine. Seriously, EMS too. Some of them are just download just awful. I mean, so are human beings. I'll take right. firefighters yeah. over cops any day of the week.
I mean, I've heard some stories about nurses from nurses that...
Right, right. There's like an NYPD versus FDNY hockey game that happens every year, and they play it at Madison Square Garden, and sometimes I watch.
Yeah,
and I root for the NYPD. Yeah.
There was some.
Oh, you don't?
I mean, sorry, no, I'm Jesus. I wow. against.
Somebody
I root against
that.
The NYPD. Do not clip that.
I root for the NYPD.
Please,
says Emma
please.
On police on
no
police
more.
Day.
I don't need another secret Nazi soundbite.
I don't give you a secret Nazi, and I support.
Okay, but
it.
Emma, what if the Emma, what if
stitch
the
it together?
What if the NYPD? What if the NYPD was playing the IDF's hockey team?
Then I'm all in.
No
maybe.
Answer.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I should just bow out.
This is like Ta-Nehisi said. Silence is sometimes an option. You can just not comment on things.
I could. But that would be against my nature. I have to have an opinion on anything or I'll die. It's like a shark. I have to constantly be moving.
Oh, my God. When I had a Guillain-Barré and I was on a cane, I was such an old man. I went by the local fire station on the way to the cafe, and I had just seen a boxing match where the opening fight was in firefighter versus a cop.
Yeah.
And I
That's
just
awesome.
Saw the fight. I was like, I saw you guys in the fight with my cane. I was root for you guys, and they were basically like, yeah, keep it moving, old man. Nobody cares.
That's so funny.
Went back to watching Rogan.
Right.
That a cane will turn you old real quick.
I would have thought that they would have been like, oh, one of us, somebody else who's got permanent brain damage from boxing. I don't know. All right, let's do this. What number is this here? Darlene, oh, 4. Darlene Graham won last night in a special election primary. It was a lot closer than you would think. She is a weak candidate, as Matt just said off mic. I mean, that clip of her not knowing anything about Taiwan went super viral in Republican circles. But Trump endorsed Darlene Graham, sibling of Lindsey Graham, and that's all you really need. But Trump won South Carolina by 18 points in 2024, and Darlene Graham only won this primary race. Against a well-known Republican, Ralph Norman. You may have heard his name before. He's been a congressman for a long time, and he's really Trumpy himself. But she only won by 5 points against Ralph Norman, despite the Trump endorsement and him rallying for her and his super PAC, spending for the first time this cycle. They've been sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars, probably enriching themselves, but probably also saving a lot of it for the general election, unlike Democrats, who are spending their money to defeat progressives in primaries. Trump's just sitting on this war chest. But he deployed it for the first time over the weekend, sending her a little over $800,000 for get-out-the-vote calls. And now it seems like his super PAC is going to start to spend. So, but, you know, Trump had been having a little bit of problems in South Carolina. There was a June gubernatorial primary, if you'll recall, where he initially endorsed this candidate, Pamela Yvette, and then it became clear that she wasn't going to win. So Trump did a dual endorsement for her opponent, and Alan Wilson ended up winning the nomination.
He's done that a few times this cycle.
Yeah, because it hasn't been that. This has not been recently the string of dominance of endorsements that he'd been accustomed to. In Florida, a few weeks ago, two of his endorsed candidates lost their races as well. And it's just because, like, Darlene Graham is a weak candidate because she's just the sibling of the former senator who seems to have very little political experience. And why Trump likes her is because she's basically an empty vessel for special interests, and all of Lindsey Graham's neocon Zionist staff that had previously been serving him so well can remain in place and just slot in the other Graham. Here she is talking about healthcare at her victory party last night.
No person in South Carolina has pushed harder for the absolutely terrible idea of turning confused little boys into little girls and vice versa than Annie Andrews.
Dumb motherfucker.
Gun control.
Now with Andrews.
Government-run health care. Abortion until the moment of birth. Bad idea after bad idea. Annie Andrews backs them all. I have a different background and vision for our state. I'm a hard worker with a servant's heart. I grew up in the back of a bar and liquor store in one room in Central South Carolina. My parents worked long, hard hours to make...
I wonder how Lindsey Graham got a taste for it.
Right. Yeah.
He, towards the end of his life, he was drunk on every cable news appearance. It was, like, immensely obvious, especially if it was after 5 o'clock and he just rolls up to, you know, talk about how we need to bomb more children in Iran. Damn. Yeah, that's why he had, like, there's no need to be conspiratorial about his death. Israel really, really, really wanted him alive because he was their best asset, and he drank like a fish and had heart problems, so that's what happened.
He was wandering around Disney World dazed, like, 5 months ago.
With a wand, a little on the nose.
Gift shop wand.
Bar and liquor store in one room in Central South Carolina. My parents worked long, hard hours to make ends meet. We didn't take vacations. If they were sick, they had to get up and go to work because the doors weren't open. We weren't making money. My mother passed away when I was 11 and my father just over a year later. For the past 30 years, I've worked hard for the people of South Carolina. And for the past 7 years, I've led a state agency. And I understand the struggles faced in South Carolina families because I've faced them too.
So she starts off railing against trans people and gun control and then government-run health care. Within a minute, she's talking about her mother dying at 11 and her father when she was 11 years old and her father dying when she was 12 years old.
And I will fight to put you in the same situation.
Yeah, exactly. You want to live in the back of a liquor store? Yeah, you vote for Darlene Graham. My parents had to get up and serve that liquor.
What's the port? Yeah, somebody needed to, like, rack the pool cues, I guess. What did they need to, like, what support did they have after that?
That's the point. She's just, like, selling their story as one of exceptionalism and then saying that this is the reality she wants to create for her constituents, if she's thinking at all.
Where parents can't take sick days?
Yeah. She's bragging that we didn't take vacations.
You know, maybe it would have been nice if you could have taken vacations with your parents while they were alive, you psychopath.
I mean, it's just kind of amazing. She has really no political ideology, and it seems like that's, except I'll carry the mantle for my brother. And you see how the financial interests that have corrupted our government see that as way more valuable than even a Ralph Norman type conservative who'd given them everything that they wanted up to that point.
Yeah.
We would rather have empty vessel with Lindsey Graham's staff and donor network entirely in place and Trump drain the swamp dude is also on this boat, by the way.
That's a great...
Than a staunch conservative that's already been our buddy even and given us everything we wanted for the most part. Apparently, like, there were some other special interests that spent against him, but I'm a little bit more dubious about, like, the efficacy of that. I think this was more just, like, Trump endorsement put her over the edge despite her liabilities.
It's a great snapshot of the trans issue in particular. And, you know, like Jesse Bodder's going at Abdul Sleep. That was a bad issue for you in 2024. Yeah, it's because we don't have a very smart country. This is the case where some, somebody who's out of her depth in Darlene Graham is put into a position, and now she's talking about trans people. Annie Andrews is a doctor.
Her opponent.
Professor of pediatrics at Medical University of South Carolina. Yeah, there's a reason that she has that position on trans people and you have a different position. It's because she knows what the fuck she's talking about and you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah. God, that contrast. A doctor running against the person whose only qualifications are that you're the sibling of a...
Was a leading warmonger concierge for the military-industrial complex, and now she just gets installed into his seat. Like, that's stuff you would hear about in, like, feudalism.
I mean, we're in a really bad year for the Republicans in this midterm cycle in terms of polling, right? This is super, super... a long shot territory, but I will say that I think that Republicans are underestimating Democrats in statewide races right now because you can't gerrymander your way out of that. Like, congressional districts, you can do all you want, but in the statewide race, that's why I think Angie Nixon, that's part of what was underestimated about her, was the fury from Black voters that they are being disenfranchised all across the South. And that is making a lot of people, in addition to the Trump economy, the war, the genocide, whatever, increasingly engaged. And South Carolina has a lot of Black voters. So I think that's even further long shot than Florida right now. But both Republicans are super weak. Both Republicans in Florida and in South Carolina, these candidates, Moody and Graham, are super weak. Neither of them have been elected yet. Moody took over for Rubio, was put in place when Rubio became Secretary of State. She's also a woman. That Republicans don't like that. And the top of the ticket in Florida is going to be Donalds, a Black man. And you're already seeing how in the more like pro-segregationist counties, there was an analysis done by Vote Hub, how it was actually depressed turnout that was atypical of a gubernatorial primary like that, yeah, in those districts that were particularly historically racist, because Byron Donalds is a Black man and he's going to be at the top of the ticket. So
imagine if there was a law passed that they had to put the picture next to the name on the ballot.
Exactly. So Black man at the top of the ticket for a very racist voter base in Florida, woman who no one has previously elected before as the senator who's currently sitting there, who's going to be going up against Nixon. Plus, a lot of voters in these statewide races that are pissed off, rightly so, about being disenfranchised by the Supreme Court and then the Republican Party. You know, these are very good conditions for upsets, is all I will say. And then in South Carolina, Darlene Graham is an open idiot that even with a Trump endorsement, didn't have a resounding victory. And it seems like Trump's been having trouble in the state for the past few months. So, yep.
I think you could throw Lindsey Graham's corpse on a podium next to a Democrat and they would vote.
I think
South
you're
Carolina
probably right. I think you're probably right. But I'm just saying, if there were really conditions for something untold, you know, something we couldn't even imagine to happen, it would be this, would it not?
Yes,
untold. Something unimaginable.
Yeah.
I'm not in the business of selling like complete hopium here, but I'm just trying to say that
a competent party would take this opportunity to press advantage. Unfortunately, we're probably going to talk about Hassan Piker for 65 of the remaining 69 days.
Oh, I'm sure we will. We'll talk about the insane harassment campaign against Hassan in just a second. Sickle Up Economy says, not going to lie, I love when Matt gets fired up over on our trans people's behalf. There you go.
Yep.
Dokio Pilled. It was a whites-only liquor store.
Was it?
Is that true?
I mean, they're old enough, but I don't know.
That would be unreal.
I don't know. I was in North Carolina a couple of years ago, and just like searching around the area, like the Wikipedias and stuff, it's like a lot of places have a Klan tab on the Wikipedia, which... I find a little bit like I haven't spent much time in the South. That's crazy to me.
I told you when I went to South Carolina last year, I was surprised to see the amount of Israel flags there.
You can also find footage of or photographs of a Klan rally in Queens too. So
yeah, and
Trump's dad there.
Yeah, yeah, right. Look into that, folks. Jimothy Cricket, when Sam isn't in, I get the vibe it's just Matt and Brian bullying Emma. Leave Emma alone. I don't think so. What? We're just shooting the shit. I'm one of the guys.
You know, on that Trump thing and the Klan rally that his dad went to, I saw this thing. It's like Elon Musk, a quantitative analysis shows that Elon Musk has tweeted about race every day for the past. The man is from South Africa and did a Hitler salute at the inauguration. Like, it's nice to have quantitative analysis, but yeah, we know he's a race obsessed Nazi. Like, yeah. What the conclusions are in. At a certain point, it seems it's like Akeem Jeffries talking about, like, it's not a hoax that there's affordability. Yeah,
yeah.
I know. What are we gonna do about it?
Right, right. Well, since you brought up Hassan, let's just get into that. Maybe all the whole Hassan section we'll get to, I think. And as you pull that up, I'll read some IMs. Glenn Beck ate my dad. Just bros being bros, said, yes. Brick City born. The wrong 80-year-olds are dying. We all know some deserve to be dragged to hell. I know, that's what I'm saying. Floyd the Barber. Yay, we won. Let's boo the opposition. Right. There's nothing that she's standing for.
It's, I mean, I'm sorry. Like, I try to be humanitarian and stuff. And, like, you listen to a bunch of these Republican pigs hoot in a group like that, and it's hard not to be extremely misanthropic.
Right. We're Everywhere says, Emma, wait till you hear my Drop It Like Tim Scott remix with Julie. May end up in E. I'm not sure I know what you mean. Eric in Poland says, I lived in New York when Giuliani was the mayor. Police Commissioner William Bratton was the reason for the reduction in crime during Giuliani's tenure as mayor. Giuliani was upset Bratton was getting credit for everything, so Giuliani fired him and has been getting exposed as just another right-wing hack for the last 30 years. Rob from MPLS says, made a small donation to Lakes Area Imagination Library. If you're able to do the same, please check if your employer matches these donations. I love that. Yes. Dave from Talon, I'm sure Tay-Tay will be this generation's Dolly Parton. You know, that's rage bait. Dolly would have never allowed herself to become a billionaire. I mean, just kidding. That's rage bait, I think, Dave. I think it is. So the harassment campaign against Hassan, this coordinated smear campaign by the Democratic Party, is just enormously shameful. I say that because he's my friend, but also because it's insanity, because Hassan is, like, actually doing good work in the country right now, electing progressives, elevating humanistic values,
fighting anti-Semitism,
educating people on liberation movements across the world. And so naturally, the Zionists and the Democratic Party want to take him down. And I think this is part of the challenge that DSA and also just like the broader movement for social democracy and the progressive wing of the party is presenting to the establishment right now, is that they don't really have a leader that can be villainized. AOC, extremely popular with Democrats. Zohran Mamdani, extremely popular with Democrats. Bernie Sanders, extremely popular with Democrats. And in the country, all of them are really popular politicians generally. So, all right, we can't define them. DSA is an organization that has a rank and file and is collaborative, but it's like not a movement with one particular political leader. So who can we assign as the political leader, the leader of this movement that we're going to make sure that people feel is so too toxic to associate with? Well, I guess streamer Hassan Piker is who they have landed on. And look at these screenshots here. Right now, these establishment Democrats seem to have coordinated. You got Hakeem Jeffries, Cory Booker, Alyssa Slotkin, Gottheimer, Richie Torres, Jackie Rosen, awful senator from Nevada, one of our worst on a voting record as well.
Ken Martin, the head of the DNC.
Yep. Going after Hassan in a coordinated way, pretending that he is anti-Semitic, when you can look at hours and hours of footage of Hassan Piker condemning anti-Semitism and making the distinction between anti-Semitism and Zionism. And yet, Josh Gottheimer, one of those politicians that I just mentioned, is calling him an anti-Semite straight up on Fox News. Why you're on Fox News as a Democrat to do this should be a question, but...
Because you're a fifth column working for Reactionary Project.
But yeah, Hakeem Jeffries was just meeting with Jared Kushner to talk about affordability, so this is what the Zionists in the party really believe in.
Hassan Piker is an anti-Semite. It is what it is, and I don't think he would even claim otherwise. He tries you're to...
This is slanderous. He has repeatedly claimed otherwise.
He's obviously not. Anybody suggesting he is a fucking loser.
Hey, Fox News, I remember Dominion, false claims being made about Dominion on your airwaves resulted in a very expensive lawsuit that you had to settle because that's a private entity. Hassan Piker is not a politician. He's a private citizen. You have a responsibility on your airwaves to not have somebody go on there and lie. Hassan has... the ability to, you know, I think, make credible claims about litigation against, what's his name? Scott Jennings, for his, like, deceptive editing and claiming that Hassan supports lynching. But are you going to tolerate this, Fox News, on your airwaves? This is a liability for you to have somebody going on there and lying all the time. I would say that that Hassan is fairly well resourced and can get a lawyer. Look out. This is slander.
That's what he is. Nobody should be anywhere near this guy. No one should campaign with him. No one should repost him. And frankly, anyone who is quiet right now is complicit. Everyone should come out against this guy, and we should vote to condemn him when we get back to Congress. Again, Mike Lawler and I have a resolution. I'm hoping that Republican leadership bring it to the floor so we can stand up to him and to people like Candace Owens who are spewing hate across the board.
Yeah. There is a... we talked about that there's a push right now to have Candace and Hassan have a conversation, and it's because Zionists like this know he's not an anti-Semite, know that he has a love in his heart for Jewish people, and this is about the genocidal state of Israel, but they want him to appear with Candace Owens so they can tag him because she's actually anti-Semitic.
Yeah, for the B-roll for their weird propaganda segments.
But it's both sides. It's both sides.
Everybody listening to this, this is not a fight to duck. This is a fight to jump into with both of your arms flailing wildly with your fists out. We need to go on the offense on this. And if they want to have this fight, let's have this fight. This is all these people that you mentioned, Booker. Take a look at how much Jared Kushner was paying him 10 years ago to get into the Senate. He's paying him like he's a fucking NBA player. Millions and millions of dollars, multiple contributions around 2013 era. Cory Booker just so happened to, I forget which confirmation it was, but a buddy of Kushner or indeed Kushner himself. But anyway, Booker was the one vote for him. But all these people have taken Israel money. This is the conversation they need to have. And we need to like dismiss it quickly and then move on to prosecuting the case against them. All these people did a fucking genocide in all of our faces, supported it and lied about it and demonized the students and people like Hassan Piker, for opposing it. They blew the election in 2024 in part with their support of this, the support of Israel. And they will torpedo this party before they let it win against the Republicans. They would let us see 10 years of Republican rule, then one term with progressives that don't support Israel in power. They are not playing the same game you are. This is the conversation they need to have so that we aren't having the conversation that indeed the tent is too big. You cannot have a party with these fucking people in it that go onto Fox News and lie and say, yeah, this guy won't even deny being anti-Semitic. That is fucking insane. But that is typical of Zionists. They cannot do better than that.
They're trying to weaponize once again anti-Semitism as a way to discourage the growing anti-Zionist movement in this country, and it's not going to work, but watch it is going to put our friend in danger.
It could ruin the chances electorally for the left, though.
That too. I mean, yeah, like, Abdul al-Sayed is now being forced to distance himself from Hassan, and Hassan helped organize, like, get out the vote.
Like,
and like, look, Abdul al-Sayed is going to do what he needs to do. Angie Nixon's going to need do what she needs to do if she doesn't feel that, like, the internals look like it makes sense for them to campaign with Hassan, but it's just criminal what they're doing, because it's hamstringing the party and a youth movement within the party that identifies with how he presents politics. And there's only so much you can do, and smearing you can do, and money that you can throw at the problem for you, the problem, to slow this roll. I mean, it's generational. This is changing. It's inevitable. But, like, we're in a fascist moment.
But in the meantime,
right,
yeah, it's kind of urgent that we don't have these fuckers blowing elections for fucking Israel.
Well, we care about a Big Ten. We're the ones that want the Big Ten. We're the ones saying it's insane that, like, there are people like this psycho, Hillary, what's her face, Shulton. Listen to this. Why do you think that there are people that don't believe that the Democrats stand for anything, when the only thing they've said that they've stood for in 10 years has been, we hate Donald Trump, we want to oppose fascism, we are against this, and not even fascism. We want to oppose Donald Trump. This administration's dangerous. It's the only
we
thing
care about
that
democracy.
They've centered around. We care about democracy, okay? So here's a Democrat who is saying, maybe I'll throw the election to the Republican in a year of fascism. Here is, you know, this Hillary Schlotten, who, unlike Haley Stevens, who understood that she wants a future in politics in the state, Schlotten is throwing herself on, you know, Israel's genocidal sword and saying that she may not endorse Abdul al-Sayed, the Democratic candidate against the Republican, because he campaigned with Hassan.
Endorsing al-Sayed, then, are you wheeling it over? Yeah. And if it is, you know, this big tent, then why not endorse it?
Yeah, so Abdul has not reached out to me yet. If he would, I would have some questions. I have not endorsed him yet. You know, and I think, as I made pretty clear, you know, a lot of it has to do with past associations with Hassan Piker, you know, current statements. And I have received a lot of feedback, you know, both positive and negative from voters in my district. And one of the things that I know is I am deeply engaged on this issue.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I bet.
About how they feel. But, you know, getting a lot of support from people who are saying, thanks for helping us to think really critically about this issue and,
oh,
and to question,
oh,
you know, whether this is the right direction for our party. But, you know, make no
mistake. So, you know what? The Democratic voters decided it was the right direction for their party. I know that the media doesn't care about democracy, but it would be nice to have one question asked of these elected officials that would reflect the fact that they don't care what their own what voters say whatsoever.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, again, why is Wesley Bell, Jared Moskowitz, or Debbie Wasserman Schultz on committees for foreign policy? 77% of Democrats last August thought that Israel was committing a genocide. There's already been a coup committed against democracy in this country.
Yeah.
It's simulated. It's completely simulated, and increasingly so in this post-Citizens United world. The amount of money that's being spent is created completely, it's a disgrace.
It's not even good politics. He destroyed in her district. Abdul al-Sayed won by over 20 points in her district. So it's
corruption.
It's corruption, right?
It's about principles.
Israel,
right.
The Israel lobby
the
has
right to kill brown children. She holds that dear in her heart.
At an acute moment of fascism in America, the Israel lobby has corrupted democracy,
yep,
and the opposition party to a point that it can't even respond.
Succinctly said, and absolutely the reality.
And so, like, look, we talk about this big tent. Hassan belongs in any tent because Hassan is good. The motherfuckers acting like what he said about Jewish people was anti-Semitic and the relationship with violence and the Israel lobby. Here's something Tony Judt said in 2003. It is a Jewish state this time, but not a Christian one, which is holding them hostage for its own actions. Diaspora Jews cannot influence Israeli policies, but they are implicitly identified with them, not least by Israel's own insistent claims upon their allegiance. The behavior is of a self-described Jewish state affects the way everyone else looks at Jews. The increased incidence of attacks on Jews in Europe and elsewhere is primarily attributable to misdirected efforts, often by young Muslims, to get back at Israel. The pressing truth is that Israel's current behavior is not just bad for America, though it surely is. It's not even just bad for Israel itself. The depressing truth is that Israel today is bad for the Jews. All these people fucking know that. That's a conversation we need to have about hate and violence and anti-Semitism. It's these people are responsible for it. It's not that Hassan's responsible for it. It's not that nobody's responsible for it. Israel and Israel's supporters are responsible for it. Yes, you are provoking violence worldwide by invoking, by protecting Israeli conquest, by invoking anti-Semitism broadly. It is you. The finger points at you. Everyone now, when you get your finger pointed at by someone like the AIPAC money takers, Cory Booker, all those motherfuckers we showed at the beginning, you point the finger right back. Do not get defensive. Point the finger directly back at them.
Yeah, and this I appreciated this from Hunter Biden, of all people here, who has now said that Israel's committed genocide. I saw his dad helped do it, but, you know,
should probably be in prison for it.
Probably, right? Okay, but, like, well, sins of the father, whatever, you know, like, Hunter Biden seems like, you know, look, the guy...
it's a tragic case of somebody who is in a... I don't know if he really understands his historical position.
No, but Hunter Biden, look, he has what his father had, which is like a lot of charisma, the ability to speak and communicate effectively. You know, it seems like has a career in media if he wants it, and he's says things, you know, I think communicates quite well and has good instincts on politics. I'll take what I can get here in terms of Hassan defense. Here he is on. I guess this is with Rick. What's his name?
Some old Republican.
Yeah, the Lincoln Project. But this is him kind of defending Hassan Piker to that very audience that would be swayed by these kinds of smear attacks.
I turn on these shows, and it's like a circular firing squad. Because
I'm sorry, pause for a sec. We just set this up. It is those Biden genes are so
crazy.
Strong. It is crazy.
Man.
Yeah. Well, no, because even then he sounded too old. This is like Joe Biden getting caught on the hot mic with Obama. It's a big fucking deal or whatever. God, it's insane.
I turn on these shows and it's like a circular firing squad because they end up talking about Hassan Piker for 45 minutes. You know what Hassan Piker did? Hassan Piker is a live stream guy that has been doing it for I don't know how many years, and he has thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of him just feeling shit
talking
into a microphone. By the way, but at the same time, you know what Hassan Piker's done? He has created a little bit of a movement of a group of people that are absolutely opposed to the fascism of Donald Trump. And you know what? I want to tap into that. I don't want to opt out of it. I want to figure out with Hassan Piker whether or not we can find common ground and fight against the same enemy. Instead, what these guys are doing is he's a virulent anti-Semite and everybody's this, that, and the other thing. And it's just like, and he said this about 9/11 and he said that. It's like, my God.
You know, what's amazing is like, he sounds so much like Joe that it would almost be a bit that we would do, feeding pro-Hassan Piker content into a Joe Biden audio filter.
Yeah, Bernie bro Joe Biden.
It's just, but it's true. It's what's
the
happening.
Debate, he just goes, America deserved that.
Oh, come on. Come on. America deserved 9/11. Jack.
A famous president once said at a very important time in this country's history, and I believe it's from the Bible, in fact, a house divided cannot stand. And this is an important time to have this fight, and it needs to be resolved because we do actually have to beat the Republicans. And you can't beat the Republicans by having a party completely led and stacked at the top with an issue that is 80% of the voters don't agree with.
Yeah.
But that isn't precisely what they are doing.
Majority Report Peace Prize, Hassan Piker, Jack. Get a grip, Jack. My Joe Biden's not that great. Sucking off the system says anyone taking money from the genocide pack is a Nazi, full stop, and they deserve to be treated as such. Not Sam Cedar. Wait, the Kamala Harris DNC invited Hassan Piker is anti-Semitic? She must be held accountable then, right? That's how that needs to be positioned. Well, they kicked him out.
Well, they will do
she
that.
She figured it too. Out. She figured out he was an anti-Semite and kicked him out.
Somebody did post, and I can't find it, but an old clip of MSNBC talking about Hassan. Actually, I can find it because Hassan quote tweeted it. But it's like, yeah, it was all positive. Didn't mention anything about the 9/11 comments or whatever. But Hassan's like, yeah, this is before I started campaigning for politicians that weren't taking Israel lobby money.
Yep.
And it's like, why are you so obsessed by it? Well, why is three Zionists on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, including Moskowitz at the top, or is it Moskowitz or Gottheimer at the top for leading Middle East policy? That is insane.
Yeah.
And it's like, will Jesse Waters even talk about that? Will MS Now? Does anybody want to talk about something real, or should we talk about some dumb horse shit about Hassan Piker again?
Majority Report Peace Prize. MSM talks about Hassan so much, I genuinely wonder how many confused viewers think Hassan is running for office. Spaghetti Brains, you guys, it must be like really sad for establishment Dems. It hurts to find out everyone hates you, even when the reason is really, really good. Come on, guys. Those poor rich Dems must be crying all the time because AOC is dunking on them all day, every day, just by existing. Please, guys, be nice.
The Hassan stuff is a major source of anxiety because I know for a fact that the staffers for these politicians, the younger ones, don't feel the same as the donors and the politicians themselves do.
Yeah. Crusty Gnome, Sam bullies Emma more than these two combined.
Nobody's bullying anybody.
Don't infantilize me. I hate that. Truly. I know you mean well, but yeah. I'm going to rub some dirt in it kind of gal.
There's no wound.
There's no wound.
Pick yourself up and dust yourself off.
Yeah. The Beach Goys says, since Zionists will dishonestly smear Hassan Piker as an anti-Semite no matter what he says or does, then why should he have to be overly cautious about who he has conversations with? Because
he's not over. Okay, that's why we don't read comments from people called Beach Goys.
Oh.
Because he's not overly cautious. He's principled, you fucking moron. He's not avoiding Candace Owens because he's cautious. It's because he doesn't want to have that conversation because it's not going to be productive because she's a fucking lunatic.
I didn't know that was about. What
now
that
that's
was about.
Bullying.
Yeah.
And I'll just say, like, if.
Sometimes it's good.
I mean, it could have been a funny comment with that name. It would have been a bit edgy, but it turns out it's a moron with that name. So.
Okay, there you go. Let's just quickly laugh about Jesse Waters. Jesse Waters had his debate with Abdullah Sayed. Abdul cleaned his clock, made him look silly as he fixated on trans sports, but Abdul wants to do Medicare for all. I forget his exact phrase, but end needless wars, put money in your pocket, etc. And he kept staying on message, and Jesse Waters even enjoyed at one point Abdullah Sayed calling Mike Rogers, his Republican opponent, a beta, got a laugh out of Jesse Waters, and Jesse didn't deny it, and Abdul called that out. Great, great moment. Not once, but twice yesterday, Jesse Waters talked about how he likes Abdul al-Sayed. Here he is in the afternoon on the 5, relaying it to them. And then he did it again on his primetime show at night.
In this case, I thought the interview was fine. Thought it was compelling. He's a confident guy, kind of a guy's guy, but I don't trust him.
Guy's guy.
You know, I like him. I don't want to like him. I like him for some stupid reason, but he's not right for Michigan.
He's not right for Michigan, but you like him. He's a guy's guy. That's him going like, that's an alpha male.
Yeah.
And I got kind of...
I want to be in his pack.
Right. Yeah. Well, they're all... That's what conservative mindset is.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
Like... being a supplicant to power, and that's why Trump, as the strong man, has been able to capture the hearts and minds of so many Republicans. So this is how you defeat fascists. You don't compromise with them. You're aggressive towards them, and then they shrink.
Yeah, you don't be like, oh yeah, how can I meet with you halfway?
Right.
You can do that when you're not bought.
Yes.
It's the only way you can do it.
Right, and that's exactly why, that's why Trump is charmed by Zoran Mamdani, because of the strength of his strength and what he's able to bring to that meeting. Same thing with the debate between Abdul Al-Sayed and Jesse Waters. Let's just get him at nighttime on his primetime show. Couldn't help himself, had to bring it up again.
I actually like Abdul. I probably shouldn't like him, but I do. I think he'd be a terrible senator. He's a little bit of a lunatic, but at least he's not your typical stiff. Hakim talked to Kushner because he wanted to help the country. Abdul talked to me because he wanted to help Michigan and himself. And we all learned something.
Bipartisanship? We all learned something.
We did learn something else about Jesse Waters. And I just want to play this part because we didn't play this yesterday. But this is Abdul Sayed being asked about sex change surgeries for minors, which not a thing.
Yes.
But which is Sayed could have responded that way, but instead he reacted in a way. And I'll again point out, like we did in the South Carolina case, where you have Darlene Graham, who's notable for being Lindsey Graham's sister, mm-hmm. a warmonger, who's burning in hell right now, mm-hmm. And her opponent being a doctor,
yeah.
or a pediatrician. Sayed is also a doctor, and but here's what he had to say to Jesse Waters on this, and I think that Jesse Waters got a little bit of a thrill from this.
Certainly. That's why he's ready to bow down and supplicate himself. He got alpha'd in the traditional ape-like way.
The idea that the government shouldn't tell you what kind of health care you should have. I just think the government shouldn't tell you what kind of health care you should have. And if you're a minor,
you
want to
try on kids?
Now, if you disagree with that, if you disagree that health care decisions need to be made by a doctor and their parents and a patient, then we agree to disagree.
I love that framing, too, because it is like, all this is like, oh, we think this decision here, whether it's about sports or whether it's about healthcare, we need your congressman to be involved.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, I love the framing. The reason we didn't play this yesterday is just because that was my one quibble, is I wish he would have emphasized that gender affirming surgery is really, really rare under 18 years old. Like,
right.
And if it does happen, it's typically top surgery. And if any surgical procedure tends to happen, it is after years of therapy, years of consultation with doctors. And so I like what's about to come, but it needs to be made in conjunction with the fact that this is a fake problem.
I would also just say, though, if it was more prevalent than it is, and we know it's not, if it was made under the consultation of doctors, it's not my fucking business.
Yeah,
I'm worried about the war.
of course.
But you're right.
But from political messaging perspective, people get squeamish about surgery and all that. So that's just my one note. But
right. Now, if you disagree that healthcare decisions need to be made by a doctor and their parents and a patient, then we think we agree to disagree. But you know, you want to put government inside.
So Abdul, you're
a
doctor, right?
Selectively.
And I'm a dumb...
So you think it's okay for a parent to slash his kid's ding-a-ling off?
I mean, look at how hysterical that gets already.
Right.
So he's already moved from, in consultation with doctors and parents. So you think it's okay for a parent to slash a...
You're a doctor, right? That's basically how
like
he sounded.
Like a man on the street, doing street harassment.
I mean, just in that exchange, you could tell he just comes off like a drunk, dumb frat boy, and Abdullah Sayed is speaking complete sentences.
But
anyway.
It's also like, you know, how he would talk to a woman he's into.
Totally.
As we're finding out.
Right.
Hey, you think that? You should do that?
Right.
I am.
So you think it's okay for a parent to slash his kid's ding-a-ling off? You think that's okay? I mean, do you really want to have this conversation? Are you circumcised? Yeah, but I mean, that's a personal question.
Okay, doctor. So you probably should want to move on.
Is circumcision's different than castration?
I think it's a problem. It's a problem that you think that you get to decide what happens between a parent, a doctor, and a patient. And I'm just saying that, yes, circumcision is surgery on a kid's ding-a-ling. So if you really want to bring that up, you can. I just think you guys are really selective about how you want to talk about these things.
Abdul?
Abdul, no. That's wacky.
Ding-a-ling to a doctor is so funny.
I think, did he say ding-a-ling first?
Jesse did.
Jesse did.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Saying that to a doctor.
Yeah.
And how Jesse has to present it, it's as if some psycho parrot decided, I saw something on Twitter about trans people and I want a daughter, and so I'm going to have a daughter.
Right.
Like that's not anything
some
that's
dad
happening.
Some dad in, Joker face
right.
paint.
Yeah.
That's how it happens. That's how the transing the kids happens. You come home from school one day, you've got your biology homework, and dad is sitting in front of this on the stoop.
Like, dad, why did you? Dad, why did
he
you?
He trashes your cock off like it's a hot intern's tires.
Right, exactly. Jesse Waters is like, I got blades for days, baby. Oh man, I've used knives to control members of my family before. Okay,
yeah,
including.
Yeah, you're right, exactly.
Including the movements of my future wife, intern, though.
Knives are for meeting women, not ruining men.
Thank you. And that is grandma. And that's the tweet. Sickle up economy. They're so dick obsessed. Yes, but in this case, it's a rare... I don't think it's a gay thing. I think it's a alpha male
I don't
thing.
Think it's a gay thing either. I think it's 100% like he... It's just that's how that male conservative camaraderie works. It's a hierarchy.
It's frat boy stuff. Yeah.
Have you ever watched like my dad watched a lot of hunting shows and like a lot of that's like, here's the two like male of like caribou or whatever and they're asserting dominance and you have to just put them down sometimes and that's what Abdul did. You can't be like, look, there are some crazy and I'm sorry about them.
Yeah.
Like, stop being a pussy.
Luke from Oregon. Abdul basically just cut off Jesse's ding-a-ling. Undead McConnell says, I wish Abdul wouldn't use words like ding-a-ling and stick to the medical term, tallywhacker. Ben from Seattle, Jesse Waters just took all the air out of El Sayed's tires after this interview so he could drive him home. Hey, dude, what are you up to after this? Sushi? Poker with the boys?
Yeah, I got a poker night. You can come if you want.
Yeah. When's the next time you're going to be in New York?
Is gambling haram? I can't remember.
AOC POTUS says, maybe it's not about who's best for the country, but bromances with alphas we made along the way, Jesse, probably. Okay. We'll do this and then we'll take a call or two. Trump called into Glenn Beck's show. We wouldn't have the modern conservative movement without Glenn Beck, so these are really kind of full circle moments. Thank you, Samantha Bee, by the way, for praising Glenn Beck and doing that segment about how heroic it was that Glenn Beck said that he wasn't a Trump supporter. How has that aged?
Samantha Bee, I haven't thought about her in forever.
It was just so egregious, and it was so obvious that Beck was going to become a Trump supporter so shortly after that, and yet she spent her time rehabilitating his image for some reason. That show was pretty
damn. She's married to Jason Jones, man.
Awful. So Trump has this insane trade war with Canada that's ongoing because he's upset that Canada is developing economic ties with China and buying their electric vehicles that are superior to ours, that have longer battery life and are cheaper.
So says our car company's executives.
And part of the problem, dude, is that you were trying to appeal to the oil and gas lobby, which they're making record returns right now as they price gouge due to the war in Iran in the U.S. But you destroyed the efforts to kind of create our own electric vehicle industry from Biden's term and just slashed all of those projects that could have at the very least made us somewhat competitive right now with China's electric vehicle market. But that's not that it's done. It's pretty much over now. So he's retaliating against Canada for daring to engage with China on automobiles. Slap some tariffs on them over the weekend, 50% tariffs on certain goods. And then Canada responded with 50% tariffs on things like steel and aluminum, which are, you know, enormously important for our economy, for the construction of homes, for, you know, the construction of anything, essentially. And so Trump is really pissed off. Seems like Canada's outsmarting us a little bit, but Trump has something, an ace up his sleeve here. He's got them. He's got them dead to rights because he's threatening to do what no president has done to Canada before.
Canada. It seems to me they had a really good deal, but this is all about the elections and throwing our elections. What is happening? Is there a way to end this?
Look, I don't know how you feel about Canada. They are one of the worst countries in the world to deal with. And this has gone on for many years.
Wait. Can we say this? I love Canadians and Canada. Correct. I do not like their administration.
Okay, well... Right?
Okay, sorry. So I listened to this before the show, and it's my favorite part where... something funny happens after this, but... Like, Glenn Beck is trying to save him. He's like, all right, we don't hate the Canadian people. We just hate their government. And
he's got
Trump
Canadian
is
listeners.
So pissed that he's being interrupted. And he just goes, okay, whatever.
I mean, this is.
I hate the Canadians. That's what he's saying. Yeah.
It's a weird thing because I don't think it's good for Carney or whatever, but like Alberta, which is the most conservative, maybe I'm wrong about this, but my perception is like the most conservative part of Canada.
Yeah.
They need to export their oil.
Right.
So they need, this is most harmful to them.
Yes. I mean, isn't Calgary also quite conservative as well? I would need to know what their top exports are. But yeah, like, that's part of why you're seeing conservative politicians in Canada, you know, not that.
Calgary is in Alberta, by the way.
Oh, Jesus.
Right? Didn't you say Alberta?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh.
I thought you were wait, was that bullying?
Yeah. You're not allowed to correct me. Everything I say is factually correct. Because I'm on camera and you're not. All right. That was dumb. Keep going.
Our elections. What is happening? Is there a way to end this?
Look, I don't know how you feel about Canada. They are one of the worst countries in the world to deal with. And this has gone on for many years.
Wait. Can we say this? I love Canadians and Canada. Correct. I do not like their administration.
My second largest market.
Okay, well, right? The administration and the previous administration, too, is terrible.
Yes.
But they have taken advantage of the United States for many decades, actually. They charge tariffs that are unbelievable, like on milk, 400%. And on life. And I just said, we're taking them on. And I took them on at the beginning. But we had so many other things to do because the country was a mess. But I said, we're going to take them on. We're going to stop it. And you saw the Lake Ontario. You know, people thought I was kidding. But maybe I wasn't. Because the last one you saw was the Gulf of Mexico. It was Gulf of America.
I know.
But now we have a Gulf and we have...
So I would just pause to point out that he's not talking about any, like, sort of manufacturing that's going to be created by this. He's talking about changing the names on maps again.
You don't understand
more symbolic manipulation,
the psychological impact that will have on the American worker. I'm not sure why you're dismissing it out of hand like that.
I think most Americans probably couldn't place the Great Lakes in the right, like specify which lake is which.
We just need a little bit more patriotism. I mean, hear him out.
Have a lake, okay? You know, it's very.
Yeah.
But now we have a Gulf and we have a lake, okay? You know, it's very simple. But look, I don't want to go into great detail because it's maybe boring to people. But to me, it's not boring. They charge
boring to him.
They take advantage of us as though they were a state, and they're not a state. And they've taken our car industry, and they've taken our agriculture industry.
Yeah.
You know, the farmers can't sell anything in there because the tariffs are so enormous. And yet they want to sell in us without any tariffs. So I had a deal that was a pretty good deal. You know, quite good, because they're afraid that I won't do any business. In other words, we won't trade. They don't have anything that we have to have, okay? We can get by. I mean, there are a couple of things that would make it a little inconvenient. But
steel and aluminum?
And it's time to teach Canada you can't do this anymore. We lose $60 billion and really more than that. $60 billion. All right, we got it.
But it's time to teach Canada that they can't do this anymore, and I'm going to rebrand Lake Ontario. I'm not, like... That is the problem here. Here it goes. Everyone knows the country of Canada has treated the United States very unfairly for decades.
I will say this is from earlier in the year, but I did want to put it into the record again because what does America get? Blah, blah, blah. Prime Minister Carney wants to make a deal with China, which will eat Canada alive. We'll just get the leftovers. I don't think so. The first thing China will do is terminate all ice hockey being played in Canada.
Oh, my God.
And permanently eliminate the Stanley Cup.
He was like, what do they like? Yeah. What do they like up there?
Mom, Donnie's going to outlaw bagels.
Yeah, right.
There's no bagels and definitely no lox.
I mean, it's like we're currently at a pivotal moment in our country's history. Our country, which, like, the auto industry has been extremely central to the dynamism of our economy. It is being surpassed by this country, China. And our dotard president, as Kim Jong-un called him, is talking about, yeah, you don't let their cars in because the next thing is they're going to not let you play hockey anymore.
Yeah.
This is idiocy. We need to have, it'd be nice to have a bit of rational policy making on some of this stuff, I guess. Maybe that's too much to ask for.
Too much to ask. All right, opening up the phone lines for a little bit, 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920.
Just, where's the NHL headquartered?
Is it Canadian? I mean...
It's got to be American, right?
When's the last time a Canadian...
It's an American commissioner.
I don't follow hockey, but isn't it the case where it's been a while since a Canadian hockey team has won the
Cup?
Yes,
it's been a real drought.
So not that they would even notice.
I think since the 90s, early 90s. Yeah, it's located in New York City.
No, Vancouver won. The Canucks won in like 20.
No, the 90s. That was, I think, 99. Are you thinking of, are you thinking of when the Canucks, 93?
93, Montreal Canadiens.
You're thinking,
when the Bruins beat them?
No, you're thinking when the Bruins beat them and there were those riots in Vancouver.
Yeah.
No, they made it to the Cup. I mean, the Oilers made it to back-to-back Cups, but the Panthers, the MAGA Panthers, swept them each time. Very unfortunate result.
Okay, and 40 people are still listening, so.
Yeah.
Well, shout out Tim Thomas.
Shout out, exactly.
Chara.
All right. 234 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 234.
Hello, this is me.
This is you. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. I'm calling from the Mahoning Valley in Ohio. My name is Tammy.
Tammy from Ohio,
I'm
what's
so
on
excited.
Your mind? Yeah, good to talk
Hi.
To you.
Yeah, I've actually been trying to IM in all summer, and I wanted to get a, I'm sorry, my damn dog. I wanted to get a Yoda orgasm chauffeur for my oldest son, CJ, who graduated high school this year with honors, and he just started college. We moved him into his dorm last week for fashion design.
Amazing.
And I was hoping that if you guys could give him that chauffeur, every time he thought of orgasm, he would think of Rave Dubin, and I wouldn't be a grandma very soon.
Okay.
Okay, well.
Here's Matt's attempt at
family planning.
Birth control, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be perfect, so.
There you go, one more time.
I appreciate everything you guys do. Thank you so much.
Oh, all right, there you go. That is the
Yes!
There you go. Have a good one. Congrats to you and your family and to your kid.
Can I just mention, go ahead. This is after the call.
No, the call. I just hung up.
Okay. My friends, Gareth Reynolds and Kyle Anderson made a movie that is touring right now around the country. You may know Gareth from The Dollop, but, it's a mockumentary about stand up and they had a hack stand up character.
Oh,
and when they were trying to write the hackiest bit they could possibly think of for dialogue, they accidentally wrote that "Coming, I am Dave Rubin" joke.
Not knowing about.
Not that. Knowing, they found out after the movie was like in the can from us.
That's so amazing.
The movie's called "Give It Up." Yeah, I just saw it. It's very funny.
I don't know. Great minds think alike.
Check it out,
I don't
folks.
Know.
Yeah, right.
Just parallel thinking. Nope.
Comedians wrote that, it must mean I'm funny, right? We all are worked. I'm in the comedian brain trust, you know.
Rubin is one of the 200 assassins.
That's true. Calling from a 901 area code. Who's this? Where you calling from? 901.
Is this me?
This is you.
My name is John. I'm calling from the biblical hellhole that is Alabama.
John, you said?
Yes, ma'am.
John from Alabama. What's on your mind? And, you know, hang in there.
Well, I actually, since you guys were on the topic of it, I work in the automotive manufacturing industry. And I kind of wanted to give sort of a quick update on where I think the tariffs have affected things the most.
Okay, go for it.
So what I'm seeing a lot of is that, yes, so, you know, tariffs are getting charged to us and to customers. And, you know, everybody is really just fighting to say who's going to pay for each one. But what I think the biggest effect is that I'm seeing is that companies are trying to basically come up with ways to save on the cost because of those tariffs. And one of the ways you could see that is potentially Toyota moving their Tacoma production from the Baja California area back into Texas, but they're not really investing into this new equipment. And I see it a lot more at my facility, where a lot of these companies are just trying to move all of their equipment over to our facilities because it reduces on the supply chain. So where they might be getting charged a lot more in the tariffs, they're saving on the supply chain, but it's putting pressure on all the smaller sub-suppliers because we're having to come up with discounts or any means just to make the large OEMs happy. And it's putting more and more pressure, and it's screwing a lot of smaller companies out, as well as nobody is taking any extra money and putting it into investments where our operators or our people are, because those people I know firsthand are scraping by on funds and they live paycheck to paycheck, and the money's not going to them. It's going straight to just the facilities saying, make these parts, and then you got to get them over to our facility within a day. And it is causing severe pain.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. And I mean, this, the uncertainty of it even in and of itself is going to create job losses. But if this stands with these materials, we're, you know, it's horrifying what this could be doing to our economy. Appreciate the context and the call. Thank you so much, John.
Absolutely.
J-Man Jay says there's a KHL team in China. I did know that, actually. Yes.
Sorry, what's KHL?
It's the Russian professional hockey league.
Oh, right. Yeah, but they'll be able to play it, but Xi won't let you play it.
Exactly.
Because you're not, you know, subservient enough to communism.
Snarkinorsky, Vancouver in the old red, yellow, and black V sweaters in 1993. I know. Their rebrand sucked. Argyle Bargle connects everyone the cup to their everlasting shame, which caused the first Stanley Cup riot, followed by the Guns N' Roses riot.
Yeah, Vancouver likes to riot.
Yeah. Do we have time to do Rob Schneider, or I just feel, yeah, I feel like we never got to it. All right, guys, that's it for calls. I'm sorry, we have
Emma
pressing
wants to
business.
Rob Schneider on the way out the door.
We have pressing business. This is our final segment of the day before I leave for my trip. So
we can take as long as you want. It's not very important.
Emma, okay,
we have 30 seconds or 40
Emma's
minutes.
Emma's like, this is like Sam when he like isn't going to be in, and it's like, oh, we wanted to talk about that Dave Rubin video.
Yes. But because, I mean, like, Tim Pool gives me a headache. Dave Rubin is so dumb.
He's retired also.
Yeah, barely working. Rob Schneider, I got so tickled by his, like, stand-up set. What was that at? CPAC?
CPAC, yeah. Where Brace Belden was in
and,
the audience.
And calling it a stand-up set is a little bit generous because, what, 3 minutes into his tight five, he was like, what else do I got?
He did a few Somali jokes, and then he's like, you can do it, and then people kept telling him to do that with Brace Belden of True Anon snapping his fingers in the first row.
Brace was loving it in the audience.
He lost all his, like, my wife is a bitch jokes after he got divorced,
right?
And so his hour was down to 30
seconds.
That's
the one reason.
Exactly. He couldn't do that anymore. But the bitterness remains. Right. And like in that stand-up set, his eyes are almost entirely closed in this clip as well. So just putting that out there.
You barely see his pupils. It was really unsettling.
So Rob Schneider, though, does have opinions about politics.
This is the hat he flips upside down whenever Adam Sandler's around. Can you spare a dime?
Excuse me. Right. Please put me in Grown Ups 4, okay?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. This is the height of masculinity.
I'm not seeing any rhinestones on the hat, so perhaps this is formal wear.
Yeah, maybe he looks like maybe he's leaving a funeral.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, exactly right. Perhaps this is when he wants to get
for,
serious.
For like Bam Margera.
politics time with Rob Schneider.
But let me tell you the thing about, like, you know, the attack on masculinity and the toxic masculinity that's happening. Like, you know, you're not supposed to be a man and this and that.
Not supposed to wear a fedora.
Unless you're a cross-dressing man. I just remember, like, when I was a kid, the similar version of this was, you know, Death Wish, which is pretty similar to this in my understanding of vigilante. I remember being in the audience when Death Wish 2 or 3 happened. We got there a little late. We got there, and there was a scene where this girl is being attacked. And then we just sit down, have our popcorn. We're in the front row. It's packed. And then she runs and goes out the window and then lands on this fence and gets impaled. And I remember, like, this is the first scene? And I remember everybody behind me was just absolutely and rightfully horrified. Yeah. And I was thinking to my brother, I'm like, if we laugh, they're going to hang us right now. And then, so I do remember, like, literally when Clint Eastwood shot, you know.
He's very rambly here.
So I just don't understand when masculinity was outlawed. Because what the example he gives is that he and his brother were alone in the theater in wanting to laugh at seeing a woman being violently impaled.
Yeah, that is not where I thought he's going. Because Death Wish, for people who don't know, is this movie about, like, basically a guy, there's a home invasion and the police don't do anything. So the guy basically kills a bunch of people.
Yeah, it's a male, like, revenge fantasy.
I thought
franchise.
He was
going
to say,
is it involving his daughter or his wife?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Whoa, a shock. You can't make that kind of movie anymore. But Liam Neeson hasn't worked, I guess, in 20 years.
But that's what I thought. I thought he was going to say, like, and so the moment he goes into the subway and, like, just shoots people, I thought that was good. But no, he's like, I thought the victimization of the first person getting thrown out of the window and dying.
Yes.
I wanted to laugh at that and no one wanted to laugh at that. Yeah, it's not supposed to make you laugh. It's supposed to make you want, like, bloodlust against, like, the criminal element in your society.
Yes, it's also not proving the point that he's trying to make.
No, there's no point. His chances are I would have laughed at it too, just because I bet the effects were terrible.
Totally.
But there's no point.
But
there is no point.
All right, all right.
We're gonna skip a little bit ahead to talk about Javier Bardem.
Okay. Well, no. I want to hear the end of this thought, and then I want to go to that part.
Okay.
Too.
I would just say, like, as a man, who am I gonna look toward to be a model of masculinity? Am I going to look towards Javier Bardem
married,
or Rob Schneider?
Married happily to one of the most beautiful women on the planet with children, and he is, like, an incredibly accomplished actor.
Like, the most handsome person in the entire world.
I mean, honestly, if I were to think of, like, the best example in my view, or just skip ahead, for, like, an example of, like, really healthy, beautiful masculinity, I'm thinking right now, Javier Bardem is my number one draft pick.
Yeah, sexy masculinity all-star.
Exactly.
I've got to be a close second, though.
Well,
Rob Schneider, like,
that was understood.
Rob Schneider trying to walk onto the team.
Yeah.
Feel lucky. What do you, punk? And then he blows the guy away. The guy goes for the gun. He
Sick.
Blows him away. And everyone, we're all like, yeah, I might kill that motherfucker. And I just remember, that's coming back.
He remembers that it's coming back.
They're sick of the liberal judges letting people off. And, you know,
I just got to say, these adult men that
turn off the TV, dog,
can't get over their childhood nostalgia. I mean, it's so sad. I know you're divorced just by the fact that you're talking this emotionally about people laughing about violence when you went to see a movie with your brother when you were a kid. Yeah. I've never
Last
seen
time
a
you
more
felt a genuine emotion.
Like you're not technically talking about your divorce, but you're talking about your divorce, right?
It's such a perfect example of how the world they fantasize about has never existed ever once. It's all Clint Eastwood and Charles Bronson.
And even then in the crowd, they were outnumbered. Like, right. They were the ones that wanted to laugh at a woman landing on the fence from the fourth floor.
Yeah.
That has popularized the idea. And, you know,
A big time moron. Just a parenthetical, if you don't know who Gad Saad is, that's pretty much all you need to know.
I do love his like half hearted attempts to seem erudite that are sprinkled throughout.
As Gad said, as Brett Weinstein once said in a podcast.
As esteemed scholar Roseanne Barr once wrote in her dissertation.
Exactly.
I also thought the bitch was white.
Suicidal empathy, judges letting people off. And, you know,
actually, we have to pause it again. What did liberal judges have to do with this? So he's basically waxing poetically about a fictional film about vigilante justice that never existed, his experience in the theater, and then says liberal justices.
The
are...
liberal judges are letting the criminals back onto the street. And they're reoffending. Which is going to cause the vigilante.
Right.
Vigilante.
No, okay. But I thought. Oh, it's going to cause the vigilante? Or
it's coming back.
If judges keep letting up people to reoffend, yeah.
Okay, the movie that
Dirty
that
Harry
never
is coming back.
Dirty Harry's coming back.
Because it was a real thing.
Right.
It's like that wrestling documentary where he's like, it's real to me, damn it.
They, conservatives, can't understand art and think it's real all the time. Okay.
Well, off. And, you know, as Gad Saad has popularized the idea of suicidal empathy, the idea is that, care more about the person that's harming you than you care about the person being harmed. Mm-hmm. When you care more about the criminal than the victim, that's a form of misused empathy.
So you misuse.
Whoa, right, dude, you're blowing my mind.
Sam has said this before, and it's just like one of it just sticks with me because it's so true. How so much of conservative media is about telling you, like, don't worry, don't let any doubt creep in, don't let any empathy creep in. You have this worldview. The suicidal empathy thing is also that. It's essentially saying if you have an experience of feeling empathy for somebody else, we're going to make them into a threat with our conservative media apparatus. We're going to turn them into a racialized threat often, or a trans threat, and we're going to make you afraid of this person that you might have had empathy with. So here's a media kind of buffer in between you and your empathy.
Yeah.
And that is what Fox News does, and that is what Rob Schneider is articulating here when he talks about the suicidal empathy theory.
I mean, Elon Musk was a famous proponent of this suicidal empathy, and he got it from the same moron in Gad Saad. Actually what it is hysterical Nazis that want you to be afraid of refugees and not the billionaires that are hollowing out your society.
Yep.
Should we keep going on this part?
I need to hear the Javier Bardem part.
Empathy.
Yeah.
I don't
misuse empathy.
So misuse is right, and he calls it suicidal empathy.
Yeah.
I don't like the term because it implies that they are actually empathetic people, and they're not. Right? I mean, you said it before.
Good one.
These are narcissists. Hollywood is full of narcissists. So the fact that they hold these views, it doesn't make sense of what these are the empathetic people. Javier Bardem. I'm not having that.
Yeah.
No.
I know.
These are narcissists, and it's just how will it make me look, and how will it make me feel? Will I feel and look like a good person?
Yeah. What's amazing is that. Rob Schneider is like supportive of whatever the billionaires want, and he still can't get roles. Javier Bardem is in like the prime of his career. He's in Dune still. I mean, did he win an Oscar for No Country for Old Men? At the very least, he was nominated for it. Just like one of our best living actors, but still employed. And when he actually has something to lose, he stood up for Palestine. And he had, prior to the genocide actively beginning in Gaza in 2023, been an advocate for Palestinian rights. So it wasn't that suicidal for him.
Is that what... I wonder...
But it actually is a risk for people in Hollywood to speak out about this. You have Paramount executives going after Mark Ruffalo because he, like, made the connection between Oracle and the genocide in Gaza, which is, by the way, Googleable.
But is that what this moron, the Daily Heretic, is that what he's saying, that... Is that where the empathy is suicidal, where Javier Bardem is speaking on behalf of Palestinians? Because By your fucking definition of the people are hurting us, yeah, I've never been hurt by a Palestinian.
Right.
The hell are you talking about?
Exactly. Well, haven't you been hurt about the concept of Islam?
Israel Israel actively fucks up a lot of elections I care about. Palestinians have never done that a single time once.
Yeah. I mean, having empathy for Israel right now would be suicidal because they are not deserving
Certainly
of it.
Certainly homicidal.
No, it is a form of vanity. That's what it is. Guise of suicide.
Says the man in a fedora.
Yeah, like, right.
Are we watching more of this, or should we skip ahead to the Jerry Seinfeld thing?
That's what we need, too.
Yes, please.
Where should I go here?
Because it seems like Rob Schneider has settled on the grievance, at least thematically, if we can put together some sort of thread here, which is that he's upset about anti-Zionist
if anybody has more information about this Daily Heretic, what is the word, tosser, let me know on social media.
All right, here we go. Here's Rob Schneider whining about the film industry. How out of character.
Guys from Somalia.
Yeah.
And they were pretty good.
They were.
So it made
don't you realize? No, all of us actors know it's all bullshit. I mean, there are some really good actors, but it's the role. We all knew that American Beauty was going to win the Academy Award for whoever got that role. We all knew. And there was a lot of us who could have done it.
Were you in the standing for it?
No, is that you know, you get so typecast. I mean, that's...
Wait, sorry, which role in American Beauty?
Kevin speaks in American Beauty.
He's like, look, they gave it to the other creep.
That is the meanest question you could have ever asked Rob Schneider. Were you in the running for the lead role in American Beauty? Well, I was really busy doing The Animal 2, so yeah. I had to turn it down. I was doing Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo.
Right, the hot chick.
It was a coin toss.
Scheduling conflict with the hot chick.
I can't believe he says we.
Yeah.
We all thought that whoever got that role... Buddy, you're not on the team like that.
Yeah, no, man.
I looked around the audition room. It was me, Daniel Day-Lewis,
Rob Schneider,
Kevin Spacey.
I mean, I'm sorry. Kevin Spacey is a
good
horrible
actor.
Guy, but a good actor, yeah. Right? Like,
that's just a fact, which is not something you could say about Rob Schneider, ever. Anybody. Schneider could be 45 for a billion years, and Hollywood could exist all those billion years, and he would not win a single Oscar one time.
Well, I mean, he is just, like, so downstream from Adam Sandler's talent. You know, he wishes he could have made the Sandler transition, like he did, you know, going into more dramatic roles and being successful at that.
Yeah.
Being in a Paul Thomas Anderson film.
A Safdie Brothers movie.
Brothers movie. No, don't laugh. He's good in those, Matt.
Yeah, he's great.
He's
great.
Really,
no, I know Adam Sandler can act.
Yes.
I'm imagining Rob, Rob Schneider in Uncut Gems.
Rob Schneider doing that scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Exactly.
In Punch-Drunk Love.
Oh, my God. He was in the conversation. He could have made the dramatic pivot, but he just, you know, scheduling conflicts.
That's such a funny thing for a bad actor to say. It's just the role that makes the actual acclaim.
We all know this.
God, he is so deeply jealous of Adam Sandler, but he can't piss him off because he's the only one that will employ him at this time.
I'm going to back it up just so we can get a little bit more lead in.
Okay, great.
Three guys stayed there. The three, you know, and... So we're getting the pirates. I mean, didn't anybody see, you know, what is it called? Captain Phillips?
That movie was not good for actors because they just got some guys from Somalia.
Yeah.
And they were pretty good.
They were.
So it made
don't you realize? No, all of us actors know it's all bullshit. I mean, there are some really good actors, but it's the role. We all knew that American Beauty was going to win the Academy Award for whoever got that role. We all knew. And there was a lot of us who could have done it.
Were you in the standing for it?
No, is that you know, you get so typecast. I mean, that's the difference. Of, I really like the French, theater and the French, particularly the film industry, and which is interesting because the United States would fund the French film industry indirectly because there used to be 11% tax up until 2000. There was an 11% or 2001.
What does this have to do with anything?
There was an 11% tax on American movies, which I thought was a pretty good idea. So because American movies at that point, Hollywood was 92% of all world cinema. That was the height of it.
I love that. He's just it's all about the role. It's not about the actor. And it's just he didn't get the right role.
It's because he's been typecasted as a gigolo, I guess. An ethnically ambiguous extra in an Adam Sandler movie is what he's been.
I mean, basically playing an imbecile in every single one of them.
Yes. I've been typecast.
The French would put me in a major film, though.
I've been typecast in a very limited role, but it's not because my skills are limited.
I'd like to see Daniel Day-Lewis do the Hip Hop Anonymous bit.
Me too. Yes.
Oh, he does ask him explicitly about Uncut Gems.
Okay, okay,
I don't know where the Seinfeld thing is, but
he does a hilarious Seinfeld impression, but we can't find it.
The two.
But it was years of having to do that. And then Adam
Sandler.
Yeah, he had to work. I mean, it's a tough thing. Nobody says, we'd like to see you do it. They go like, after they see, oh, yeah, he can do it.
Yeah.
We can all do it. Uncut Gems.
I had not known that I hadn't seen this far that he talked about Adam Sandler explicitly, and I called it. Did I not?
Yes.
And he walks into his famous catchphrase almost with the "You can do it." They think you can do it.
Yeah, yeah. But he's trying to talk about how he could. I could do it. Yeah. I could be a serious actor.
You know, my whole life it was "You can do it," but nobody ever said "I can do it."
I'd have to tell other people they could do it.
I've just been giving and giving and giving and giving. When's anybody going to ask about me, Rob?
Anyone's going to give me some encouragement.
But he had to work. I mean, it's a tough thing. Nobody says, we'd like to see you do it. They go like, after they see, oh, yeah, he can do it.
He can do it.
We can all do it.
Uncut Gems.
Yeah,
uncut,
which was great.
Could you have done that role?
Yeah.
You admit that. So I've heard Anthony Hopkins, I've heard Colin Firth. They're asking, "What is your method?" And they
no follow up there.
What is Rob Schneider's method?
Thank you, Adam. Anything else, Adam?
Oh my god! Oh my god! That's so good.
He can do it.
Wow! Wow! There you have it. God. All right, guys. Gonna read some IMs and then we'll get out of here. Hogtown. Rob Schneider dressing like David Paymer in Payback for some reason. I don't know that reference. Dark Soul. Imagine replacing Mark Tam in Dune and just hearing "You can do it" and being yelled at during dramatic scenes with Paul.
Rob Schneider in any movie is so funny to think about.
I know. Oh, God.
Rob Schneider and Michael Clayton.
Reflecting pool algae, Dave Bautista, a former professional wrestler, has been more successful at transitioning to dramatic roles than Rob Schneider has. I mean, many wrestlers.
Yeah. You think John Cena would trade places with Rob Schneider? No way.
I would say most wrestlers could act better, like even ones
the
that
Rock.
Have never acted.
Yeah.
Okay, John Cena in Trainwreck is funnier than Rob Schneider has been in any movie, by the way. And I can't rewatch Trainwreck anymore because Amy Schumer is just so horrendous, but he's great in that movie.
But I mean, not to bring up old wounds here, but Roddy Piper in They Live is better than anything Rob Schneider has ever done.
I'm really sorry for not getting They Live, okay? It just wasn't for me. I got so much backlash, and I felt badly because my husband really liked it too, right? And it's for men, I think. Maybe. It might be for men, okay? Yeah.
They sell the DVD in the Just for Men box.
Pretty much, yeah. Right. You get a 3-pack of Hanes boxers.
You get beard dye and a DVD.
Yes, there you go. Hack all the things says, can you guys add "You can do it" to the soundboard? We should.
Turns out he can do it.
Dimesh said, okay, Emma was right. The Rob Schneider bit was worth it. And the final IM of the day, we'll say Kowalski from Nebraska. Emma, I hope you enjoy your short time off work going to your friend's wedding. You said you hooked these two friends up, which I think is really cool. You're like the maverick to someone else's goose. Now that being said, you're 32. I'm 32 and would imagine most of your friends are around that age. I would also appreciate having a wingman. Just put in a good word with your friends. I think my Instagram speaks for itself. If you do not do this, I will support the pro-bullying Emma movement. Also, I'm going to be on Leftist Mafia tomorrow and dropping a video tonight on Prairie Fire Neb, so shameless plugs. Kowalski, I will keep you in mind, and I do follow you on Instagram, so I'll have it easily accessible for my single friends at the wedding. Yes, I got to give a speech. I got to work on that. It's going to be going to be really fun. I'm excited. Thank you guys, and thank you, Matt, for filling in for me tomorrow. we'll have a pre-recorded interview that I did earlier this week tomorrow, and we'll see you then. I'll see you live on Monday, and thanks so much for watching. See you guys.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got